Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Death Row had three cops, and it's in a circle. Right here is a list of every cop who partnered with Mac.
You best to get on?
Didn't have to, because there was only one stupid enough to blow $25,000 in Vegas with Mac 2 days after the bank robbery. Rafa Perez. The department forced me to follow Liga for stealing cocaine. Guess who was actually stealing? Because I made him famous.
Officer Perez, I've got some suspicious activity.
I'm at 1010 East Caesar E. Chavez Avenue. Stand by.
Oh, what the fuck? How if I turn that shit off?
Tranquilo, tigo. Tranquilo.
What's up? You want my candy or what?
Yeah, I found another distributor.
Hey, that's good for you, but you're not stiffing me on this, fool.
I'm not. I'm gonna get rid of you.
All units be advised, Officer Perez fired with intent. I repeat, Officer Perez is the assailant.
Send an ambulance to this location right away.
All units stand by. We got 1638 needs backup.
Officer Perez! Hands in the air!
The suspect is shooting at the police officer.
Turn around slowly to your left until I tell you to stop.
10-4 Central.
What are you going to do? You going to shoot me?
Are you wearing your vest?
Nah, you too pink, motherfucker.
Now! Chest on the ground!
Shot me,
motherfucker. Now! Kick back your legs. Cross your legs. Point your toes. Cross those legs. Point your toes. I want those hands out. Hands out! Sir, I'm calling an ambulance. It's on its way. You're gonna be fine.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 22, 2020. 2021, so I have been told. I was reminded that date should be important. Speaking of gangsters and thugs and criminals, today marks 10 years to the day Anders Breivik, race soldier, white terrorist, killed reportedly 77 people in Oslo, Norway on this date, 2011. They have the movie about the incident, which is appropriately titled July 22. But I saw that in the news earlier today. Also, just wanted to make sure I got in before we get to the book. We're reading about the assassination of Tupac Shakur and Christopher Wallace and a lot of these folks connected to so-called hip-hop and what have you. We are just a few days from the passing of Biz Markie. Earlier this year, we had DMX, who passed away, Shock G from Digital Underground, who is directly connected to Tupac Shakur, and then also Black Rob, Bad Boy Entertainment, all passed away this year, and none of them reached the age of 60. That is some privileged black male rappers for you. Rest in peace, B.I.Z. All of that said, this is the book club, seventh installment, Randall Sullivan's Labyrinth. You heard at the beginning from the 2018 blockbuster film, Movie of Lies. I meant City of Lies, had it right the first time. And that scene specifically, I said last week that I was going to play it. Last week, we heard about the arrest of Rafael Perez. Remember, Sullivan called him a shapeshifter. Ooh, he's one of those tricky non-white people. He's got this accent. He's Puerto Rican. And is he a Negro? And all the rest of it. And then when he talks about when he went to arrest Rafael Perez, he said that he was following him. And he called in backup. He called in the helicopter. And he got those wild eyes. About to shapeshift into a Negro and slice my head off. And he didn't do anything. The wild eyes of Rafael Perez. And I said, wow, that's really different than what they have in the Movie of Lies. It's really different because that's the scene that you just heard, the arrest of Rafael Perez with gunfire and he's shooting down some drug seller and all the like. What? We got to make Russell Poole a hero. Ah, he saves the day and comes in and shoots old Rafael Perez and even gets his leg injured in the like, get out of here. Like, you can't even dramatization, they call it. Anywho, we will go ahead and get started. We should have one more session left after this week, so we have plowed right through Randall Sullivan's book. Be thinking of major points that you'll take away. What has stood out to you about this film? Does this seem like a lot of people, this is the narrative that they accept? What's presented in City of Lies, the movie, what's presented in this text, that Suge Knight, Death Row are the most nefarious organization ever. They had everyone west of the Mississippi terrorized and frightened of them. They did whatever they wanted, including anal rapings, killings, beatings, and nobody could do anything about it, including killing Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. Is that the narrative that people like accept? They think like, yeah, that Randall Sullivan, he hit the nail on the head. Like, wow. Woo, give me some footnotes. Let's go ahead and get started. Lots of audio extras today, too. Context of white supremacy. Labyrinth. Audio segment one.
Chapter 11. Russell Poole's own police career already had wound down toward its sad conclusion. My weakness was that I let it all get to me, Poole said, this pattern of sabotaging the investigation that I saw again and again. The way it all piled up really affected me emotionally. For the first time in my career, I was witnessing a cover-up and an obstruction of justice in the LAPD, and the whole thing was being orchestrated from the highest levels. I knew the chief was behind it, and that Internal Affairs was in on it with him. So who could I go to? The FBI? All through the autumn of 1998, Poole bit his tongue and bided his time, watching as Ray Perez escaped conviction in court and the assorted investigations that had led to the Rampart detective's arrest languished. My one hope was that when the criminal case against Hewitt got filed, I would be called as the main witness for the prosecution and finally get a chance to tell the truth, Poole said. But it didn't happen that way. First, the same senior detective who had attempted to have Poole thrown out of the robbery homicide division back in May was slowly worked into position to testify as the authority on the case, even though I was the one who had put it together, Poole recalled. Finally, I went to Commander Schatz and asked, "What's the status of the criminal case against Hewitt and Cohan?" He said, "Well, I don't think we're going that route. Having them fired is good enough." I talked to the state attorney general's office, and they agreed. Poole made the audacious move of visiting two deputy district attorneys he had worked with on earlier cases and telling them how frustrated he was by the way his investigation had been thwarted. They were nervous and didn't want to put themselves in the middle of this, he recalled. They told me, "Let's wait and see how this plays out before you make any more allegations." Russ was stressed out and exhausted and very disillusioned, recalled George Castillo, who had prosecuted several homicide cases with Poole's assistance. I knew him to be one of the best LAPD detectives I had ever worked with, probably the best, and one of the most honorable people I've ever met. The guy is a total straight shooter, so I never doubted for a second that he was telling the truth. But the whole thing was very complicated, and it wasn't entirely clear where the LAPD was going with all this. So my advice was to wait and see. But I think Russ believed he'd waited long enough. I felt for him. As soon as word got out that he had attempted to circumvent the LAPD's chain of command, what little support Poole enjoyed in the upper echelons of the department was withdrawn. During November of 1998, he was asked first to leave the task force, then to transfer out of the robbery homicide division altogether. "I knew I would be a marked man for the rest of my career," Poole said. "Disloyalty is the one sin the LAPD won't tolerate. But at the same time, my record was a real problem for them. I had dozens of commendations and years of rating reports that very few detectives could match. And one of the things I'd been praised for over and over again was my dedication to the department. So getting rid of me wouldn't be easy, and they knew it. It was a stalemate situation." Poole seriously considered submitting his resignation and taking his case to the media. Instead, he decided to use the enormous backlog of sick time he had accumulated to consider his options. "I had taken hardly any sick days in my 19 years on the LAPD, so I had about 900 hours of time saved up," he explained. "I talked to my dad about the situation, and he agreed I should take a couple of months off to rest and reflect on what I was going to do. Poole's doctor provided him with a diagnosis of job-related stress, and the LAPD did not challenge it." Poole's 11-week leave began shortly after Thanksgiving. "I was just trying to recharge my batteries for most of that period," Poole recalled. "I spent more time with my kids than I had since they were born, and my wife and I really got reacquainted. I was working out 5 days a week. I took some long hikes with my dad in the desert." Poole's father was dealing with some major stress of his own. 2 years earlier, Ralph Poole's other son, Gary, had disappeared without a trace. It was a complete mystery. Police could find no evidence of a violent abduction, yet it did not seem likely that Gary Poole would take off on his own accord. His apartment was intact, and his bank accounts were untouched. The only thing Gary owned that was missing was his Ford F-250 pickup, and the vehicle never had been recovered. The 36-year-old man had no criminal record, and there was no suggestion that he was involved with dangerous characters. In fact, Gary had been much more introverted than his older brother and their two sisters. The artist, everyone in the family called him, because all through school his favorite activities had been painting and drawing. When I did an inventory of his home, I found many artists' notebooks filled with his sketches, and they were amazingly good, Russell Poole recalled. Somehow, that was the hardest moment for me. Gary had made a good living as a master tile setter, doing mostly custom jobs on expensive homes. He'd recently been hired to do a bathroom at Bob Hope's place in Palm Desert, a job he seemed to regard as his Sistine Chapel. "We'd never had any kind of tragedy in our family or anything that was even close to having a family member disappear," Russell Poole recalled. "So it hit us all very hard. We'd have these family meetings to try to figure out what might have happened, and everyone was blaming themselves, even though we didn't know what it was about." I did a lot of thinking about my brother during that time I took off. I started thinking that maybe I should use my skills as an investigator to work on finding out what had happened to him. I really didn't believe in the LAPD anymore. For years, I'd been able to tell myself that I might not make a lot of money, but at least I had a job that let me work on the side of truth and justice. Honor and integrity of the case were always what mattered most to me, but once I went downtown, I learned that the people who actually ran the department didn't give two shits about any of that. To them, it was all about politics. During one of their hikes in the desert, Ralph Poole told his son about his darkest hour as a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. Right after he was promoted to detective, the older man recalled, he had been assigned to the Internal Affairs Division and immediately caught a case in which another deputy, working by himself, had killed a burglary suspect. A preliminary investigation revealed that the suspect had been unarmed and that the deputy had planted a gun on him to justify the shooting. Homicide investigators quickly realized what had happened, but transferred the case to Internal Affairs so they could avoid filing charges against one of their own. He had no choice but to make the arrest himself, Ralph Poole said, and to testify against the accused officer as the lead witness for the prosecution. The day he arrived at the courthouse to take the stand, he got caught alone near an elevator, the elder Poole recalled, and was immediately surrounded by 7 or 8 friends of the defendant who told him he was a rat, then began to close a circle around him. He would have taken a beating for sure, Ralph Poole said, if not for his veteran partner, who showed up to stand beside him, and convinced the others that they would be killing their own careers if they didn't back off right now. Cops were always going to protect one of their own, Russell Poole's father told him. It was the real police code of honor, part of the us-against-them mentality that the job produced in almost anybody who did it. The only protection an honest cop could count on was the support of his superiors, and if they were corrupt too, you were all by yourself. I never thought I'd hear him say it, Russell Poole recalled, but my dad told me he thought I ought to resign. While still on leave, in December of 1998, Poole returned to the LAPD's robbery-homicide division, armed with signed resignation papers that he presented to Captain Tatro. I told him why I wanted to quit, Poole recalled. I laid out all the corruption I'd witnessed in detail, and Tatro made me feel as if he was going to take some action and talked me out of resigning. I remember him telling me, Russ, you're very intense, and that's okay. I'm very intense, too. Like we were sort of cut from the same cloth. At the same time, however, Tatro made it clear that Poole would not be returning to the task force. Neither Lieutenant Hernandez nor any of the other supervisors wanted to work with him, said Tatro, who advised Poole once again that it would be best if he transferred out of RHD altogether. In the meantime, the captain said, he could join the bank robbery squad. So I said, fine, I'll go to bank robbery, Poole recalled, but they never assigned me any cases. After a week or so of sitting at my desk and doing nothing, I figured, okay, I'll find myself another job. Being back with the LAPD, even as a glorified observer, made Poole think of all that he loved about the job. Easily the most frightening and exhilarating part of the job in his trainee days had been vehicle pursuits, Poole recalled. The suspect is running red lights, so you have to go through also. As a probationer, you don't get to drive, so you're on the radio, but some of the partners I had were a lot more aggressive behind the wheel than others. Just going through an intersection with one of those guys was unbelievably scary because there were some really close calls. You just can't understand the adrenaline pump you get when you're chasing armed felony suspects until you start to do it. It's indescribable. Poole decided to try returning to what he knew and phoned Lieutenant John Duncan at his old unit, South Bureau Homicide. Duncan said they didn't have any openings but would take Poole on loan from RHD until a spot became available. Poole went to work at South Bureau Homicide in January of 1999 and was permanently assigned to the unit 2 months later. He continued to follow the investigation of police corruption that now was split between the robbery homicide and internal affairs divisions. Brian Tyndall always made me feel there was hope that this all would be made right, Poole recalled. Even after I was assigned to South Bureau Homicide, he was trying to get me back on the task force. But Lieutenant Hernandez and Commander Schatz refused to consider it. They felt that letting me take the witness stand in any criminal case connected to any part of the investigation would result in a major embarrassment for the department. Tyndall remained a source of information and inspiration for the disaffected, however. The senior detective not only confided to Frank Liga that the wiretap on the Rafael Perez residence yielded persuasive evidence that Perez and his blood associates had targeted the undercover cop to punish him for killing Kevin Gaines, but advised Russell Poole that Brian Hewitt had made a bid to blow the task force investigation wide open. This had happened during an interview by internal affairs investigators who were looking into allegations that Hewitt had stolen marijuana seized from an 18th Street gang member. Tyndall, who had heard the tape, said Hewitt stopped the interview and told the IA guys, "Look, if you want a story, I got some things that will blow Rampart out of the water." And the IA investigators said, "No, we don't want to know about that. We just want to know about this one incident." I was stunned when I heard about this. Hewitt knew a lot, and I think he was ready to tell it if he could get a deal. Tyndall and I both couldn't believe that they never asked Hewitt about this again. Tyndall wasn't going to challenge the brass, though, and that's where he and I parted company. For Poole, the lawsuit filed by Johnny Cochran against the city of Los Angeles on behalf of the Gaines family had become his last best hope for a full airing of truths that the LAPD seemed determined to suppress. Even though he was now at South Bureau Homicide, the city attorney's office had named Poole as the chief witness for the defense. In May of 1999, the detective was riding in an elevator with Corey Brent, the assistant city attorney who was handling the case, when Brent answered a call on his cell phone and was informed that Cochran, Chief Parks, and City Attorney James Hahn had negotiated a settlement. It was one of the most cynical deals in the city's history. Because municipal bylaws required every legal settlement in excess of $100,000 to be approved by the Los Angeles City Council, Hahn had structured the deal so that Gaines's wife and two daughters each would receive separate settlements of slightly less than that amount, totaling $250,000 in all. Even then, the payments were broken into 12 parts so as to further shield them from the scrutiny of overseers. The retired Superior Court judge who had presided over the settlement negotiations was outraged, however, firing off a letter to Chief Parks stating that he believed the settlement was political and intended to avoid significant adverse publicity for the department. City Council members Laura Chick and Joel Wax almost immediately blasted the deal as deplorable and unconscionable, but admitted they lacked the power to overturn it. Hahn, Cochran, and Parks all refused to comment, but each had gotten what he wanted. Hahn was a bland political hack whose only real asset was his last name. Former Los Angeles County Supervisor Kenneth Hahn was a legendary figure in Los Angeles' black community, and justifiably so. In 1965, shortly after the Watts riots, the elder Hahn had been the only white politician in L.A. courageous enough to meet Martin Luther King Jr. at the airport when the civil rights leader arrived to survey the damage. His son Jimmy stood for nothing more than the advancement of his own career, but ever since entering politics, he had depended upon overwhelming support from the black community to win election. James Hahn now was running for mayor of Los Angeles and understood that preserving his relationship with the city's black leadership was essential to his chances for success. And no black leader in Los Angeles was more influential at this moment in time than Johnny Cochran, who not only would pocket a third of the money from the Gaines deal, but also could tell his supporters that he had stuck it to the mothers one more time. By going along, Bernard Parks had prevented a public airing of Kevin Gaines's conduct and of the LAPD's failure to deal with it. The chief also had made sure that Detective Russell Poole would not be on the witness stand telling people about the cross-pollination between the city's black gangs and its black police officers, and about how Parks had stifled his investigation of the black cops who worked for Suge Knight and Death Row Records. Poole's disenchantment with the LAPD now was nearly complete. Parks goes in with Hahn and Cochran on a deal to pay off Gaines' family when they know that Gaines is a criminal, a dirty cop, and a maniac, not to mention totally in the wrong in this case. Poole fumed. How can he get away with this? Corey Brent attempted to set the record straight, telling reporters, "Frank Liga adamantly opposed a settlement. He wanted a trial. He wanted the truth to come out." Cochran and co-counsel Carl Douglas had no evidence against him, despite all their efforts. "That was good of Corey Brent, but Frank Liga still had a cloud hanging over him," said Poole. "They had been promising him his day in court, then they took it away from him. Of course the guy is going to be bitter." That Liga was. Parks and Hahn, in concert with Johnny Cochran, Liga said. laid me out as a racist killer, a reputation I still have to fight every single day. He did indeed. During the next 2 years, Liga would be named as a defendant in 22 Rampart-related lawsuits, even though he had never worked in that division. Like Poole, Liga was infuriated to learn that the LAPD's task force had abandoned the theory that Ray Perez stole his cocaine in retaliation for the Gaines shooting. We already knew that Perez called up Property Division and gave them the ID numbers for the dope that Liga booked into evidence, Poole said. That tells you he knew what he was after. It was quite a coincidence, conceded Richard Rosenthal, but Perez insisted he had no idea who Frank Liga was. Impossible, said Liga. Apart from the enormous publicity that surrounded the Gaines shooting, Liga once had supervised a narcotics operation that Perez worked on. There's no way he doesn't remember me. The same month that the Gaines family settled with the city attorney's office, May of 1999, Rafael Perez made his deal with the Los Angeles County District Attorney. When Poole learned of it later that summer, he knew that any hope for rectification was officially dead. Rafael Perez is a pure scumbag, Poole said. To see him crying on the stand about all the terrible things he's done, I bet he laughs all the way back to his cell. Almost as soon as news of the deal with Perez was announced, Poole observed, Fred Miller and the other senior detective who was his new partner submitted their resignations to the LAPD. I think they thought Perez was going to spill on the Biggie Smalls case and it would come back to them, Poole said. But I knew Perez would never betray Mac. Perez knows for certain that if he rolls over on Mac and Knight, they will track him down and have him killed. David Mack would face sentencing for bank robbery in September, only a few days before the confessions of Ray Perez were made public in a series of articles published by the Los Angeles Times. Despite overwhelming evidence, his conviction had been a close call. At one point during their deliberations, 11 of the jurors signed a note sent to the judge in which they complained that the 12th member of the panel was refusing to discuss the evidence and had decided to vote not guilty before the trial began. This juror was black, and the other members of the panel, Hispanic, Asian, and white, wrote that they were being hung up by a race issue. Only after a stern warning from Judge Robert M. Takasugi did the jury deliver a unanimous verdict of guilty. Mac's attorney, Donald Ray, had offered the court dozens of letters praising his client, including one written by Olympic track great Carl Lewis, in a vain attempt to have him released on bail. His wife and children wrote especially emotional letters that had the odd effect of making Mac seem both more sympathetic and more contemptible. Mac also received letters of support from Sammy Martin, who praised his former partner's professional manner, and from the former Harry Billups, a.k.a. Amir Muhammad, who lauded his college friend for remaining true to his convictions and dedicated to the principle for which they stand, then signed off as Harry Muhammad. At the sentencing hearing, Ray made what is known in the law as a tragic personal history argument, citing Mac's lack of guidance as a youth and disadvantaged upbringing. The assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case replied by reminding the court that David Mack and his wife had a combined income of six figures at the time he committed his crime. This was a defendant, the prosecutor noted, who has embraced his offenses, has never apologized for them, and evidently intends to keep hundreds of thousands of dollars. Before passing sentence, Judge Takasugi gave Mack a chance to tell the government where the money could be located. On the advice of his attorney, he declined, said Mack. Takasugi then sentenced the defendant to 171 months in federal prison. Mack's request to be incarcerated in Southern California was refused, after the Bureau of Prisons reported that it would be unable to meet his security needs at any of its West Coast facilities, and placed him at the federal prison in Waseca, Minnesota. Erlyn Romero, who had been the main witness against Mack at trial, received a sentence of 30 months in prison and would be eligible for parole within 16. 10 days after Mack's sentencing, LAPD Chief Parks held a news conference to announce that he had formed an internal board of inquiry to examine the quality of the department's investigations into officer-involved shootings. Parks' announcement coincided exactly with news reports that two civilian witnesses to the shooting in which David Mack allegedly had saved the life of his partner, Ray Perez, were claiming that the victim, Jesse Vincencio, did not have a gun in his hand before Mac killed him. The pair had never been interviewed by the LAPD. Ray Perez continued to insist that the shooting of Vincencio was justified. As far as I'm concerned, he told the Times, David Mack was a hero that night. LAPD detectives who had interviewed Perez said they were all impressed by how determined he had been not to implicate Mack in any crimes. They viewed this less as a reflection of Perez's loyalty to his former partner, however, the detectives said, than as evidence that their informant was terrified of Mack. Russell Poole agreed. During his investigation, Poole had been amazed by the level of fear Mac appeared to inspire in those he dealt with. Mac must be some piece of work, Poole said, because rarely do you see people so convinced that crossing a guy will get them killed. It wasn't at quite Suge Knight levels, but it was close. Suge had been removed from the California men's colony in San Luis Obispo back in May, right around the time Ray Perez was cutting his deal with the district attorney's office in Los Angeles. He was now at Mule Creek State Prison, a facility that was somewhat less strict, but also a lot farther from Los Angeles. The nearest town was Ayon, population 2,667, a former gold mining camp 43 miles southwest of Sacramento, where residents could not help but notice the limousines that showed up on Thursday and Friday evenings when inmates were allowed to receive visitors at the prison. Among those dropping by was Michelle, who continued to identify herself as Suge's wife. Michelle's album was Death Row Records' biggest release of 1999, heralded by company publicists as evidence that the label was determined to change its image as the home of gangsta rap. Suge also had found God, his spokesperson said. If that's the case, maybe he'll be moved to confess to the murder of Biggie Smalls, Russell Poole observed. Knight remained the main suspect of an investigation that was going nowhere. Police in both Los Angeles and Las Vegas reminded reporters that murders went unsolved all the time. Murders don't go unsolved when the victim is a celebrity who gets shot dead in the street in front of dozens of witnesses who can identify the killers, Poole answered. Remind me of any recent cases where that has happened, other than Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. Murders like that only go unsolved if the police don't want to solve them. Poole was feeling free to speak his mind because he knew his career as an LAPD officer was at its end. In August of 1999, the department announced that it was disbanding South Bureau Homicide in response to a plummeting murder rate in Los Angeles and the rest of the country. We were given a list of places we could transfer to, and one of them was the Organized Crime Unit, Poole recalled. I was all set to go there when a lieutenant who had just transferred in from Robbery Homicide intervened and said they didn't want me. I went to Lieutenant Duncan to ask what happened, and he told me the lieutenant had told him, we're not going to accept Poole because of what happened while he was on the task force. My complaint that they obstructed justice was considered a betrayal. Poole transferred to Harbor Division Homicide, but 1 month later, the deal Ray Perez had made with police and prosecutors became public. Poole was so disgusted that he felt he now had no choice but to resign from the LAPD. Before doing so, however, he took care of some unfinished business. He had been haunted, Poole said, by a story Kevin Hackey had told him about the 1993 murder of two Compton police officers. One of the slain men was Smokey Burrell, Reggie Wright Jr.'s former partner. Hackey said that it was common knowledge that Burrell and Wright were robbing dope dealers of their money and narcotics on duty. Poole's notes of the interview read, "They were notorious for stealing money." Hackey says that the person who killed Burrell, Regis Thomas, may have been robbed by the two officers, Burrell and Wright, on previous occasions. Before submitting his resignation, Poole took his notes to two LAPD lieutenants, a captain, a commander, and to the office of Chief Parks. What worried me was that the guy who killed Burrell had gotten the death penalty, he explained, yet may have thought he was protecting himself from another ripoff or even defending his life. I wanted to make sure this was investigated before the guy got executed, but nothing was ever done. Poole also delivered his investigative files on the Biggie Smalls murder, including the evidence that implicated Suge Knight and LAPD officers associated with Death Row Records, to William Hodgman, the assistant district attorney, who had become a public figure during the O.J. Simpson trial, but was best known within the local law enforcement community as the liaison between Los Angeles County and the federal government. Hodgman also was the prosecutor who had gotten Suge Knight sentenced to state prison. I still hoped somebody, someday, would make use of this stuff, Poole explained. It wouldn't be Poole, however. On October 25, 1999, Russell Poole submitted his letter of resignation to the LAPD. It contained just enough information to let Chief Parks and the rest of the department's brass know that he believed he had the goods on them. The issues and circumstances of my resignation have to do with how some investigations I was involved in were handled, Poole wrote. My concerns were addressed to my superiors, but were swept under the rug. Part 5. Heat from a Cold Case. Poole is a team player who makes himself available to assist others without regard to the time of day or night. Poole is a quality person who has found his calling. He has become one of the finest young detectives on the department. From the performance evaluation report filed on detective trainee Russell Poole for the period from 3/1/89 to 9/30/89. Chapter 12. Shortly after his resignation from the LAPD, Poole agreed to cooperate with the Los Angeles Times. This would be, he eventually concluded, one of the worst mistakes he ever made. The Times reporters, Matt Late and Scott Glover, had been phoning me for months trying to get me to talk, Poole recalled. A couple of days after I turned in my detective's shield, I finally called them up and said, okay. I gave those guys everything I had, and then they came out with this story that was completely fucked up. The Times' story seemed simply sensational when it ran on the morning of December 9, 1999. A former Los Angeles police officer already in prison for bank robbery is among the suspects in the 1997 slaying of rap star Notorious B.I.G., according to sources and confidential LAPD documents obtained by the Times. The article began. Among the theories LAPD investigators are pursuing is that ex-officer David A. Mack conspired with Death Row Records founder Marion Suge Knight to arrange the contract killing of the 24-year-old rap sensation whose real name was Christopher Wallace, according to a former detective on the case. Specifically, detectives are trying to determine whether Mack arranged for a longtime friend to carry out the attack outside the Peterson Automotive Museum on March 9, 1997, according to sources and Los Angeles Police Department documents. Police would not say whether they have been able to locate or question the man they suspect of being the gunman under this theory. He is Amir Muhammad, who was known as Harry Billups when he and Mack were college classmates at the University of Oregon, according to sources and documents. Muhammad apparently dropped from sight after visiting Mack in prison on December 26, 1997. The Times article was vague about what police had done to pursue the theory that Amir Muhammad was the killer of Biggie Smalls, describing Muhammad as a shadowy figure who was impossible to locate. Detectives searched for Muhammad, but many of the addresses that came up in a background check were either false or led to post office boxes, according to LAPD robbery homicide documents. Police surveillance of some of those locations failed to find him. Numerous attempts by the Times to locate Muhammad through public records and a former friend were unsuccessful. The former detective on the case, who had been the Times reporter's main source, couldn't finish the article the first few times he tried. "I was just in shock when I read it," Poole recalled. They made it sound like the case was about to break wide open, instead of describing how the investigation had been thwarted. It was like the LAPD was on the brink of arresting this Amir Muhammad for the murder of Biggie Smalls. What I had told them was that nobody ever really looked for Muhammad because the brass didn't want to conduct an investigation that might lead to LAPD officers, and that the clues that implicated David Mack were basically discarded. I tried to get those guys to do another story that got it right, but they wouldn't. The Times would do another story almost 5 months later, but this article read more like a veiled retraction than a clarification of its earlier report. The newspaper's May 3, 2000 article was written by business reporter Chuck Phillips. "Man no longer under scrutiny in rapper's death," read the headline. "Probe, mortgage broker had been investigated in Notorious B.I.G.'s slaying, but police say theory is not being pursued." The main source for Phillips's claim that the LAPD had rejected the idea that Muhammad might be involved in the murder of Biggie Smalls was Dave Martin, identified in the Times article as the lead detective in the case. "We are not pursuing that theory and have not been for more than a year," Phillips quoted Martin as saying. Phillips also interviewed Amir Mohammed himself, who told the reporter, "I'm not a murderer, I'm a mortgage broker." The Times' earlier article made it sound like I was some mystery assassin who committed this heinous crime and then just dropped off the face of the earth, which is the furthest thing from the truth, complained Mohammed. He had not left his house for 3 days after the article ran, Mohammed said, for fear that one of Biggie Smalls' fans might be provoked into an attempt on his life. Phillips' article actually raised many more questions than it answered, but almost no one in the local media seemed to recognize that fact. Mohammed's attorney told the Times' reporter that 1 week after the first article ran, LAPD detectives had assured him that his client was not a suspect. They would like to interview Mohammed, the detective said, but never followed through with their request, the Times reported. Why not? Was the obvious question, but if Phillips had asked it, there was no evidence of this in his article. Amir Mohammed himself cited the failure of the LAPD to interview him as proof that they obviously realized at some point it wasn't true, that he had been involved in the murder of Biggie Smalls. All it really proved, though, was that the LAPD had abandoned a viable theory without even a perfunctory investigation. Phillips' article also did not offer any explanation of why the LAPD had rejected the theory that David Mack, and possibly Amir Mohammed as well, were involved in the murder of Biggie Smalls. There were no questions or answers about how Mack and Mohammed had been eliminated as suspects or what the scope of the LAPD investigation had been. No one was asked to explain why Russell Poole's requests for warrants to search Mack's home, to run forensic tests on his car, and to examine his financial records were refused, despite an enormous amount of probable cause. Among the most obvious questions that Phillips apparently hadn't asked Amir Mohammed was this one. Why, if your visit to David Mack in jail was an innocent contact between two old friends, did you use a false address, a false social security number, and an out-of-service phone number when you signed in at the jail? And the biggest question, of course, was why, if what Amir Mohammed said was true, he hadn't sued the Los Angeles Times for libeling him. In New York, these questions would have been asked the first day and every day afterward until reporters got answers. But Los Angeles was a long way from New York. The West Coast city had only one daily newspaper, but even worse, it had an alternative press that was more driven by political agendas than journalistic obligations. The rest of the local media not only failed to demand answers from the Los Angeles Times and the LAPD, but instead made a mob attack on the city's one real newspaper for running the first article that named Amir Mohammed as a suspect in Biggie Smalls' slaying. The firestorm of criticism was ignited by an article in the online edition of Brill's Content that accused the Times of running Phillips' article as a way of avoiding the full retraction owed to Amir Mohammed. The claim that Mohammed was a suspect in the murder of Biggie Smalls turns out to be dead wrong, Brill's Content reported, and the Times' failure to acknowledge this only compounded the newspaper's sins. The LA Weekly promptly published an article under the headline "A B.I.G. Mistake" that chronicled the behind-the-scenes battle in the Times' newsroom. After Phillips' story was ready for publication, the Weekly explained, the reporter and his editor in the business section, Mark Saylor, were beset by editors from the Metro section who reportedly wanted to play down elements of Phillips' story that raised questions about what Matt Late and Scott Glover had reported and were successful in watering it down. Saylor, who had engaged in a public screaming match with the Times' executive editor, Leo Walensky, shortly after the Brill's Content piece was published, told the Weekly that the atmosphere in the newsroom was tense and uncomfortable. Saylor resigned from the newspaper shortly after this. The Weekly did at least speak to Russell Poole, reporting that the retired detective admitted he was the only member of the LAPD who had wanted to pursue the theory that Mack and Knight had convinced Amir Mohammed to shoot Wallace, and that he advised Late and Glover that he hadn't been able to check out the theory in any detail because the department's brass refused to grant permission. In fact, Poole says, the reluctance of his partner and supervisors to take the Mack Mohammed theory seriously was one of the reasons he quit the force in disgust, the Weekly reported. The paper then dismissed the evidence linking Mack to the murder of Biggie Smalls as gossamer thin, however, and the implication of Amir Muhammad as even more tenuous. Since the paper had done absolutely no independent investigation of the Mac Muhammad theory, though, all its editors knew was what they read in the Times. The Weekly's reporting was top-notch compared to that of the New Times of Los Angeles. The city's other major weekly told its readers that Amir Muhammad was an innocent mortgage broker who had not been a suspect in the murder of Biggie Smalls for at least 7 months before the late Glover article that identified him as such ran in the Los Angeles Times. The New Times quoted an unnamed police source who said the LAPD had not pursued the Mac Muhammad theory because top investigators felt it wouldn't hold up, but provided absolutely no explanation of why not. The paper then leveled the inevitable charge of racism, quoting unnamed cynics inside the paper who believed the Times would never have embraced such flimsy evidence if the target had been a prominent white businessman instead of a Nation of Islam member. The New Times sank even lower by illustrating editor Rick Barz's column with a drawing of Amir Muhammad being lynched by two white male reporters. The most predictable and audacious comments on the Mac Muhammad theory came from Suge Knight's latest attorney, Robin J. Yanis. This whole idea had come and gone a year ago, Yanis said, and was being recycled by the LAPD to cover their butts. Yanis then said, Suge doesn't know David Mack. Suge most certainly did, however, as more than one witness already had told the LAPD. For Russell Poole, the media fiasco that had ensued following the publication of the Chuck Phillips article was perhaps even more disillusioning than what he had witnessed as a member of the LAPD. It was like the cover-up had been covered up, this time by the media, Poole explained. When one took a close look at what actually was said in the avalanche of articles that castigated the Los Angeles Times for its original story on the Mac Muhammad theory, they boiled down to this. Amir Muhammad could not be a murderer because he was a mortgage broker. David Mack had been cleared as a suspect in the murder of Biggie Smalls because the LAPD said it wasn't investigating that possibility, and the only reason these two had been singled out for mention was that they were black. The Los Angeles Times' credibility was out the window as far as I'm concerned, Poole said, and this Rick Barz guy at the New Times, what a stupid shit. None of these papers, not even the Times, did any probing whatever. They didn't ask the right questions, so how could they get the right answers? The idea that Amir Muhammad must be innocent because he was a mortgage broker especially infuriated Poole. Back in 1994, the detective had arrested a mortgage broker named Willie Darnell Hankins for shooting a man to death in an office on Wilshire Boulevard. During the course of an investigation that involved the subsequent murder of the accused man's father, Willie Hankins, whose real estate loan business had made him one of the wealthiest men ever to emerge from the South Central Los Angeles ghetto. Poole was astounded by how skilled these guys were at manipulating and covering up in financial deals. Working as a mortgage broker is a perfect way to make dirty money look clean, he explained, and that's what a lot of them do. He had heard a number of stories back then, Poole recalled, about mortgage brokers who were helping gangster rappers and other members of the Bloods gang launder the money they made from drug and weapons transactions. Poole also recalled that the investigations of Kevin Gaines and Rafael Perez had shown that both men boasted about the large real estate portfolios they were able to accumulate. I realized that there might have been a connection there to Harry Billups, or Amir Muhammad, or whatever he calls himself, Poole said. For me, the fact that he's a mortgage broker only raises a lot of new questions. It was really painful to find out that not only the LAPD, but also the Los Angeles Times, doesn't want those questions answered. The Los Angeles Times had been serving for months as the principal publicist for the accusations of Rafael Perez. The story that Perez had made a deal and was talking to the cops became public on September 16, 1999, one day after Bernard Parks held a news conference to announce that a total of 12 LAPD officers already had been relieved of duty on the basis of what Perez said. Nino Durden was the only one named. "It's not a good day," said Parks, who only a few hours earlier had handed out 18 Medal of Valor awards to employees of the police department. For the Times, the most important revelation to emerge was bannered across page one of the paper's Metro section. Ex-officer says he shot unarmed man. Prosecutors at that moment were attempting to have Javier Ovando released from state prison, the Times informed its readers. The headline on the story in the next day's edition of the Times announced that Perez had implicated another officer in a second shooting as corruption probe widens. Even at this early stage, the newspaper reported, the probe had become the most extensive inquiry into LAPD conduct since the 1930s. LAPD corruption probe may be test for city leaders, read the headline on the Times' next article. Already the paper was framing the story in the context of the Rodney King beating, the brutalization of minority victims by blue-suited brutes, and a police department that required the oversight of civil rights activists to protect them. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office announced that day that it was suspending enforcement of its anti-gang injunctions against more than 100 members of the 18th Street Gang. The day after that, the Times published a lengthy interview with Rafael Perez, under the headline, Ex-Officer Calls Corruption a Chronic Cancer. What he had done to Javier Ovando haunted him even in his dreams, Perez told the paper. I go to sleep with it and wake up with it. It's something I have been living with for almost 3 years, and I wanted to find some closure for me, and in a sense, a beginning for Mr. Ovando. This is something that I'm doing for me and for my God, and something that I need to do to make me whole. Bernard Parks addressed the Los Angeles City Council the next day and told them that many more officers than the 12 already suspended would be subject to investigation. We take Rafael Perez at his word, said the chief, whose admission that we may end up with a lot of information we can't prove seemed to slip past the ears of most listeners. Horrifying, the council's most left-wing member, Jackie Goldberg, called the contents of the chief's briefing. We're not going to put blinders onto these allegations, an anonymous official of the U.S. Justice Department advised the Times, which reminded readers that federal officials have been monitoring the LAPD for the last several years. A week later, attorneys for Javier Ovando's two-year-old daughter, Destiny, filed a $20 million claim against the city of Los Angeles. On and on it went, for weeks and then months. No one watched with more dismay than Russell Poole. Ray Perez, one of the dirtiest cops in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department, was playing puppet master to the whole city. The politicians and the media not only didn't question Perez, they used what he said in every way they could to destroy the LAPD, Poole lamented. The public parsing of Perez's confessions had become a kind of cottage industry for the political left in Los Angeles. The LA Weekly and New Times published story after story that attacked both the officers and the administration of the LAPD, while at the same time celebrating the murderers, drug dealers, and thieves who had become the official victims of the police abuse attested to by Rafael Perez. How many innocent people are imprisoned because of false testimony by Los Angeles police officers? Asked USC law professor Erwin Chemerinsky in the first sentence of a commentary published by the Los Angeles Times in December 1999. The answer was that there was no way of knowing, since the only LAPD officer proven to have perjured himself in court was Rafael Perez, upon whose allegations Chemerinsky's question was based. An independent task force needs to be created immediately to ensure unbiased review of all the possibly tainted cases, Chemerinsky asserted later in his commentary. This task force should be composed of prosecutors, defense attorneys, and others with experience in the criminal justice system. In other words, people such as himself. Ramona Ripston, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California, also cited the allegations of Rafael Perez in the commentary she wrote for the Times, asserting that because of them, long-standing claims that such abuses exist beyond Rampart are increasingly plausible. Ripston proposed creating the position of permanent prosecutor to investigate and prosecute police misconduct, a kind of in-house Kenneth Starr who would not only usurp the authority of the district attorney's office, but create a new bureaucratic bailiwick as well. One subject Ripston didn't want to discuss was her close friendship with Nick Salikos, the LAPD captain who had been running the Rampart Division when most of the corruption alleged by Rafael Perez occurred. No one took better advantage of the Rampart scandal than Tom Hayden, who was regularly using the op-ed pages of the Times, as well as the TV appearances they generated, to become the public face of advocacy on behalf of Javier Ovando and other members of the 18th Street Gang who had been victimized by the LAPD. Hayden was not an opportunist, of course, but an idealist, as he'd been demonstrating ever since he had used his movie star wife's money to win election to the California State Senate almost 2 decades earlier. Term limits were about to force Hayden to give up his Senate seat, however, and since he had no chance of prevailing in a statewide election, his only hope for a continuing political career was to win a seat on the Los Angeles City Council. Like virtually everyone involved in local politics, Hayden was aware that minorities were becoming a majority both in Los Angeles and all across California. Hispanics had outnumbered non-Hispanic whites in L.A. since 1990, and the disparity was mounting day by day. White people now were less than 50% of the population statewide as well, and with skin as pale as Tom Hayden's or James Hahn's, a politician needed a very broad ethnic base to win public office. The Hispanic citizens of the Rampart District, however, didn't seem to understand that they were supposed to be more afraid of police officers than of gang members. Polls consistently demonstrated the depth of support for the police in Hispanic communities. Almost immediately after Rafael Perez's allegations were published in the Los Angeles Times, local citizens staged a well-attended and wildly enthusiastic pro-Rampart Division rally outside their LAPD station. A rally to protest police abuse that was scheduled to take place the next day fizzled for lack of participation. The allegations of Rafael Perez, though, were embraced with fervor by the Los Angeles Times. A May 2000 editorial published by the paper began, "The Los Angeles Police Commission and its staff face a task that would have been unimaginable as recently as a year ago, restoring credibility to a department that long rested on its reputation for incorruptibility, a reputation we now know to be hollow." The Times apparently knew this because Perez had told them so.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade, first audio segment, all done. We will pick up. We are still in chapter 12. We'll have one more section after today, and then we'll be all done. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have written commentary, not able to dial in, we can share as we proceed. Let's see. We have additional audio commentary, written commentary. We'll do a little of both. I'll start out with a little bit email. One of our investors, he wrote in, "Greetings, Gus. This book reminds me of the celebrated biography written by Peter Maas and subsequent award-winning film Serpico." That's one of Dr. Kanban that he recommends. Starring the great Al Pacino, Scarface. From the 1970s, the lone virtuous cop who fights against the widespread corruption of NYPD. The reality is that Serpico was later thought to be not quite so virtuous, and I suspect neither is Poole. I would be surprised if Randall Sullivan was not at least a little influenced by this work, Serpico, and Peter Maas. Chapter 11. On October 25, 1999, Russell Poole submitted his letter of resignation to the LAPD. Poole, "My concerns were addressed to my superiors but were swept under the rug." Poole was allowed to retire, I assume, with his full pension. Contrast that with the treatment of Brian S. Bentley, who also exposed corruption by LAPD. Guest on the program, was that like a month back? Not that long ago? Let's see. Did we get this far yet? Let me see. Yep. Chapter 12. Number 1. The Times, LA Weekly, and the New Times all persisted in describing Perez as Hispanic, even though he was half black. Wait a minute. I don't think we got that far yet. We'll stop right there. I thought we did it first, but yeah, we'll hold off pause on that when we finish up the rest of chapter 12. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to chime in. If we have any of the folks who saw City of Lies, right, and then what we heard last week, we heard the intro of the gun battle where, you know, Russell Poole gunned down the shape-shifting Negro Rafael Perez, you Spanish-speaking Negro, and gun him down. What are you doing? Get out of here trying to kill off these gun drug smugglers and all the rest of it, which is not what happened at all. I know you can dramatize things. You want to make it more interesting, give people their explosions and gun battles and all that so they'll be attentive and feel like they got to see something exciting in their story. But really? Really? This is the back to that Serpico, right? Virtuous cop out battling crime and these no-count scoundrel officers. What do we think of this change in the film City of Lies and or other topics, parts that we discussed today? Rob in Southern California. World champion Milwaukee Bucks. Aren't you ready to move back to Wisconsin? You can go celebrate with the Greek Freak. Rob in SoCal with us.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay. So the first audio segment seemed like just a lot of, I won't say unnecessary details, but it really didn't keep my interest that well in the first audio segment. What did stand out to me was that when he was talking about, you know, well, the first thing was his father, you know, like his father telling him, oh, you know, I had to, the worst day of my life on the job was, you know, when I had to go after one of my own. And, you know, that made it seem like, you know, this pool guy just come from a long line of truth tellers that stood out. And then, when he was talking about basically how he got forced out, for being a snitch or, you know, doing the right thing, that the part that stood out with him telling his story is that I think it was some of the most truth that was told in this book thus far is him saying that police officers look out for their own. So I thought that was a really a nugget of truth right there. And the last thing I would say is I think I'll hold it for right there, and then I'll chime back in if we have more time before we get to the second audio segment. And thank you for taking the call. Thank you for listening.
Much obliged, Rob in California. Didn't hold his attention. He said unnecessary detail. Felt like that I guess the side anecdote about his family, I would say that I would agree with that in terms, because the rest of it is just a lot of innuendo and rumor, and gotta hope you can find a report to substantiate things that he's talking about in the text. Let's see, I think Henry in Chicago with us as well. Nab other hands as we proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, everybody. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The last chapter starts off with the the victimization of Russell Poole, kind of like analogous to, you know, telling him how great of a guy he is and giving his, you know, performance reviews. So, you know, Russell Poole was this, you know, good cop who tried everything he could to solve the Christopher Wallace murder, and he was basically stopped by a bunch of black LAPD officers who did not want to solve the case. Ralph Poole, Russell Poole's father, explaining the situation of the dirty cop while he was a LA County sheriff was interesting, because the way the author conveys it You know, it's so funny. The author conveys much of the perpetrators who are black as black people. But when he talks about Ralph Poole's situation of the dirty cop, the author never identifies the perpetrator's race, which I'm assuming that these race soldiers were white. But yet again, like I said, he never identifies them. If, you know, if I'm mistaken, please correct me. And same thing with Russell Poole involving the case of Brian Tyndale and Brian Hewitt. You know, their racial classifications are never revealed. But I'm assuming, like I said, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming that these two officers are also white as well. However, he does identify the city councilman, James Hahn, as a political hack, but he also identifies him as black as well. The first LA Times article Poole tried to get the LA Times to do, he said he wanted the articles to lead to an investigation to the LAPD officers. What he probably really wanted to do was lead the investigation to black LAPD officers, since he's so adamant about black LAPD officers. He was talking about how warrants search warrants for homes to Mac's house was refused. Typically, a judge signs off on that. And if a judge doesn't find significant evidence or reasonable search, then obviously the judge is not going to sign off on it. Now, you know, I'm not to say that I don't know clearly about the situation, but I just kind of find it hard, especially for a white judge, if this is the case, or probably any judge, that if they find, you know, dirt on black police officers, then they're not going to run with that. I'm pretty sure that there was a purge metaphor of black LAPD officers or officers in total from police force. Obviously, the interview with Brian Bentley, where his training officer told him that he was trying to get him fired. So any situation that presents itself as getting rid of LAPD officers, I'm just kind of find it hard to believe that a judge would not sign off on that. I may be wrong, but, you know, like I said, I just kind of find it hard that situation to believe. And also, too, the last caller who brought up Russell Poole, well, not the last caller, but the email where you're talking about Russell Poole and Brian Bentley, their contrasting cases of after they resigned. And it's interesting, they both resigned in 1999. And obviously, Poole revealed corruption amongst the LAPD, and he was not investigated as Brian Bentley was. So that was I also picked up on that as well. But that's all I have on you, Paul and I.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Again, Brian S. Bentley. Folks can go back in the archives just this earlier this summer and hear more details. Exactly what he said. Look at here, brother in blue. I'm not here to train you properly. I'm trying to get you fired. That's what he said, Brian S. Bentley. Excellent contrast as well between these two whistleblowers, right? That's what they say, right? In terms of how they were treated, Russell Poole now gets, you know, all these interview requests and is becomes, I was going to say martyrized. Is that a word? Martyrized? I think so. They make him a martyr in Movie of Lies, right? And then he get this whole book to tell his story over. Like, does Brian S. Bentley, does he have a movie? The Brian S. Bentley story? Played by Denzel Washington? Did we miss that one? Maybe that's coming out 2022. The Rona held that one up, maybe. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, commentary to share.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Thank you for the program. I came in kind of late, so I only found one thing in the audio segment that I heard that I could that piqued my interest. I believe it was Officer Russell Poole talking about a mortgage broker of some sort and suspecting this mortgage broker of a crime and he was like upset because other officers didn't expect a mortgage broker of the crime because he was a mortgage broker. Now, the story is what interested me about how he heard of a mortgage broker named Willie. And that means like the story was told and he said that's what all of them do. Then he started talking about rappers and things like that. So it was interesting, just because I don't think it was the job title. I think it was the race of the job of the mortgage broker. And that was just like really interesting. Like this mortgage broker must be a crime because must be a criminal because a man named Willie did something sometime. It sounded like a convenient story for the situation. That's all I have on my mind. Thank you.
How about that? Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Now I can take our last two callers, right, their commentary and put them together. So Henry in Chicago was contrasting how Randall Sullivan writes about black people who misbehave, allegedly, put that in, and then how he writes about white. Well, we're guessing, right? Are these white people? Because he's not identifying them as such, and he doesn't tend to do that with black people. He makes it known. This Rafael Perez is not white, shape-shifting, no-count, confusing, conniving, killing, drug smuggling, probably killed, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't do that with white maldoers. Now, let's see. Mo in Dallas, he's talking about Willie Hankins. So let's see. The idea that Amir Muhammad must be innocent because he was a mortgage broker especially infuriated Poole. Back in 1994, O.J. Simpson, the detective, had arrested a mortgage broker named Willie Darnell Hankins for shooting a man to death in an office on Wilshire Boulevard. During the course of an investigation that involved the subsequent murder of the accused man's father, Willie Hankins, whose real estate loan business had made him one of the wealthiest men ever to emerge from the South Central Los Angeles, wait for it, ghetto. There's the identifier. See, now, they do have white ghettos, but I don't think Sullivan, like, there's certain words what I've said throughout. Nigger. Nation of Islam, gangbanger, black. These all seem to mean the same thing in this book. Ghetto, that's another one. Got our identifier. I think Darnell Hank, is it Haskins? Haskins, Hankins, sorry. I think Mr. Hankins, ghetto, probably a gangbanger, negro. Could be wrong. Let's see. Got anything else? Poole was astounded by how skilled these guys. Uh-oh. That might be enough. That might be too. Well, that's a little more vague, but we'll at least put a pin there. How skilled these guys were at manipulating and covering up in financial deals. Working as a mortgage broker is the perfect way to make dirty money. I think that's in the word, guy. Dirty money look clean, he explained. And that's what a lot of them do. He had heard a number of stories back then. Poole, that's even interesting, too. A number of stories. He didn't say reports. Words are important. He didn't say reports. He didn't say there were a number of police cases, arrests, convictions, stories. In my opinion, City of Lies is a story. He heard a number of stories back then. Poole recalled about mortgage brokers who were helping. Mortgage brokers who were helping gangster rappers. talking about niggers again, and other members of the Bloods gang launder the money they made from drug and weapons transactions. It's like the most nefarious people in the world are all black in a system of white supremacy. Are you outside of your flipping mind? Whew. I was going to give commentary, but instead we will pause. I said we have extra audio treats and such today, so we'll do. This is a rewind back. DVD, we didn't get to hear all the interviews, so Russell Poole, Randall Sullivan together. Listen to how they are talking. Again, we got Negro leadership is the bane of our existence. Johnny Cochran, Al Sharpton, Maxine Waters, they will be the death of civilization. This is DVD Hard Knock Radio speaking with the author Randall Sullivan, former LAPD officer Russell Poole.
Well, you know, being the former lead investigator, I was the only one that maintained contact with Mrs. Wallace, giving her updates on how the investigation was going. When I was taken off the case, I kept it alive by always trying to keep it. I was actually trying to get the leadership, and that includes Chief Parks, to look at these clues. The case had not been solved, and there was a series of clues that pointed in the direction of at least one or two police officers involved in our department.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as far as helping Mrs. Wallace, I'm certain that I'm going to be subpoenaed in her lawsuit. There's no question about it. The woman deserves a full probe of the death of her son. And it hasn't been done yet. It's been ignored. A lot of this information has been out for quite a while now, and they still haven't gone out and re-interviewed these witnesses and interviewed some witnesses that haven't been talked to yet. There doesn't seem to be any interest in doing that. As far as the Tupac Shakur, I'm sure, David, you've done your homework on that. Tupac Shakur was becoming a very outstanding actor, and it was it came to Suge Knight's attention that Tupac was going to leave Death Row Records, and the evidence shows you just don't leave Death Row Records and get away with it.
Now Suge emphatically insists that he wasn't.
Well, you know what? You can listen to Suge all day, and that's been the problem. Suge Knight has had like a key to the city. He and others in the Death Row organization have been listed as suspects in several violent crimes, and then amazingly enough, the case does not get filed. And I go back to the fact that there was a district attorney that he worked with privately. This district attorney rented his Malibu home to Suge Knight and David Kenner. And so,
anyway, there's no question Tupac was going to leave Death Row. I just want to make that clear. I mean, if you have any question about it, call Charles Ogletree, who's probably the leading black attorney in the United States.
Yeah.
And he'll tell you he was hired to do was get Tupac away from Death Row Records alive. That was essentially his job.
And Tupac knew if he was going to be killed, he knew it was going to be somebody from the Death Row organization. And, when you really probe into that incident that night, it all started with the fight, the Tyson fight, and then this incident at the casino involving this Compton Crip named Orlando Anderson.
Right.
And the information I received was that incident was staged to provide a motive that would make the Compton Crips the number one suspect in the murder of Tupac Shakur. You got to remember, after that incident, Suge's entourage leaves. They go to Suge's house for an hour or two, and then they plan this a trip to Suge Knight's nightclub in Las Vegas. And at the last moment, security measures were changed. And I got this information from security guards that were working for Suge Knight. And many of those security officers were police officers. And it all comes down to what good are these armed police officers anyway, because none of them chased the guy. None of them fired their weapons. If they did, they'd be fired from their job. So, you know, all in all, when you look at this case, there was Shug knew he could make a lot of money with Tupac out of the picture. If he leaves, there's going to be problems financially for Death Row.
So, yeah, this isn't just Russell Poole's theory, by the way. I mean, both of Tupac's main bodyguards, Kevin Hackey and Frank Alexander, have told the police that Shug set Tupac up to die.
Right.
Snoop Dogg has told the police that Shug had Tupac killed.
But and I don't Shug hasn't been charged. Shug hasn't been convicted.
I don't think there's enough evidence to do it.
And in all fairness, you know, there are people that are also connected with the camp, you know, that say otherwise. You know, have publicly said otherwise, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know,
Shug has publicly said he got hit by bullets fired at Tupac's car, and we know for a fact he was not. So, you know, he's the fact that he lied about that is a matter of absolute fact.
Yeah, but these things were printed in the paper. But
no, he said it on national television.
Yeah, I know, but these were also printed in the paper, you know, that this happened. So
I interviewed the Las Vegas detectives, and I heard Shug Knight's interviews. He didn't get interviewed until about 5 days after he ran. He didn't stay and give his statement originally. Then he comes back 5 days later with a statement.
Hello? And, for people that just tuned in, we had a technical glitch for a minute, but we got it straightened out, and we have Russell Poole back on the line. And, Russell, if you could continue your point.
You got to remember, you know, after the O.J. Simpson case and what a circus atmosphere that became, the Las Vegas politicians didn't want the same occurrence in Las Vegas. And basically, the information I received from investigators, no matter what was going to happen, they weren't going to have a big trial in regards to this.
Okay.
I mean, that's just a fact of life. And then Shug Knight is good friends with the mayor, Oscar Goodman, I believe his name is.
Yeah.
And so
Let me ask you this. We keep going back to, you know, Shug's political connections and what have you. That is not unusual. Or tell me, is it unusual? If I have $1 million, a multi-million dollar, you know, hundreds of million dollar a year business, that's going to give me access. I mean, come on.
You know what? I can really care less about that. The more power to them.
Right.
What I cared about is we had our own police officers on our force connected to his company who employed gang members who were killing people every day in South Central Los Angeles. I mean, I've got a list right here of unsolved murders in South Central in a 10-year period. It's over 1,500. And so, you know, this type of feud between East Coast, West Coast actually feuded a war in the Los Angeles and Compton area. And, you know, during the course of time when Shug Knight was coming up and he was starting the company, we had a series of murders that involved up-and-coming rappers. And at the time, the information we were receiving was if you didn't come to Death Row, you know, you weren't going to be in business. And so Shug had a lot of power. All he had to do is hire the right people. And, you know, in any chain of command, all you got to do is give a wink and a nod, and somebody else would take care of it for him. That's how powerful he was. And so I could really care less on how Shug made his money. My job was to try to solve the Biggie Smalls case and make the connections, put the dots together.
Now, we'll...
It involved police officers on our department, and the citizens don't want our police officers associating with gangsters off duty.
Now, let me ask you this. Will all this come out if you're subpoenaed to go to trial?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I've been, you know, I've gone to every law enforcement agency I can, and they're all afraid to probe this incident.
Not because of Shug.
Yes.
Law enforcement is afraid of Shug that much?
Oh, not so much now, but, man, he was a powerful figure. He was, like we were talking about, he's well-connected. And he was like hands off, and that's part of the motive on why this thing hasn't been fully investigated.
But now in Los Angeles, there's quite a few people other than Shug who are hands off.
But you know, I've never seen. I got to tell you, I mean, whether it's deserved or not, you can we can argue that point. But I've never seen anybody inspire fear like Shug does. When the Rolling Stone piece came out, had virtually every movie company in L.A. make contact, want to do some kind of a movie, and every time the big obstacle was Shug Knight. And I remember I was talking to Nick Cassavetes, who's a big screenwriter in L.A., and I said, well, what is it? Is it the racial politics of it, or are they afraid of Shug? And he said, they're afraid of Shug, man. They're all afraid.
What about you guys? How come you, Randall, I mean, you didn't come in here with an entourage?
No, because I don't think that I'm what...
I mean, Shug comes to the Bay Area
a lot. Yeah, I know he does. I don't think that I'd be Shug's target. There's no record of him going after a white journalist, or I mean, the fact is, all of his victims are black. So that alone, I figure, gives me some amount of
I mean, Vanilla Ice, you know. Well, Vanilla Ice
was roughed up at most. I mean, he wasn't, you know, Shug didn't hurt him really, and I think that may have been a little exaggerated.
So, if you was a black journalist, you think I would?
I'd be more afraid if I was black, to be quite honest, because there's no doubt that I mean, so far, the people Shug's gone after have been black because they're, for some reason, he thinks they're easier to get to, and maybe they are because, you know, they're mixing more socially. But so, and there's that. And I mean, Shug is many things, but not stupid. And I think he's well aware that if any harm came to somebody who's been a contributing editor at Rolling Stone for 20 years, he'd have the International Media Corps breathing down his neck in no time, and they'd be a lot worse than the FBI.
Now, Shug's number one bodyguard was murdered 2 weeks ago.
Right, we were just talking about that off air.
And the story continues, and it's going to continue. I mean, that right there is an intriguing investigation.
Are you concerned because if this does involve fellow police officers, which you say, and if these charges and these allegations and all the things that you raise in the book hold to the facts? I mean, if I was sitting here, I'd be like, look, you know, there's a lot to be lost here. So what's keeping Russell Poole, you know, moving and shaking at a time when you could pull down an entire house of cards and really just, you know, do a whole lot of discrediting for, you know, the country's number one police force?
Well, you know what? I lost something big. I lost a job that I loved very much. And, during the course of all these investigations and them trying to block the investigations from moving forward, certainly caused a great deal of stress in my life, and that includes my family. And I had to take in consideration my family because of it. They were living with me going through the stress of trying to solve this case. You know, Christopher Wallace is not here to testify, so it is my job to go out and find the witnesses and put the puzzle together for the family members of Christopher Wallace. And never in my career was I ever told to stop an investigation or stop from probing into a case. And you know, I had to find out for myself on why. And you have to really check out the information. Randall says it all just about in this book.
Right, and the book's name is Labyrinth.
Yes.
Just for people who are interested. Let me ask you this because we're getting ready to wrap up in a few minutes. I did a show maybe about 4 years ago, and it was a really interesting show because we were talking about gangs. And one of the things about the show was we were talking about gangs that existed within the sheriff department and L.A. Police Department. We had people that were worked and been a part of it that were talking about LAPD used to square off with the sheriffs. And you had little gangs like the Cavemen, and people had pictures and gang signs. And I mean, I even saw something on the Discovery Channel with the crash unit where they had their little rituals. Was it that unusual for black officers who you said were affiliated with the Bloods? Would that be unusual in the backdrop of, you know, having the charges levied that there were gangs or people who took on gang-like behavior in the L.A. Police and Sheriff Department?
Well, you know, you got to understand, it's just a small percentage. Most of the black officers would not want to work alongside these officers who were working off duty for death row.
I can
guarantee that. Okay, the number one priority for a police department is the the safety and the security of its police department. If you've got a organization like Death Row selling drugs and being investigated by the FBI for racketeering, it's just definitely a conflict of interest. These officers.
No, I mean, I'm not disputing that, Detective Paula. I mean, I'm 100% agree with you. I think that's despicable behavior. But what I'm saying is that before Death Row, you know, was at its heyday, you still had the situation where you could point to and say, well, here's these guys that are exuding some sort of gang-like behavior, whether they were the cavemen. I wish I should have bought the magazine and the book.
Now, that stuff was 30s and 40s.
No, this was 1990s. I remember we had the show.
That behavior would not be tolerated under certain management. Okay? It wasn't a... See, Willie Williams, I knew Willie Williams, and Willie Williams was a nice man, and he was not a corrupt police chief. He never had a chance from the get-go, being an outsider from the East Coast coming in. And he assigned Chief Parks his assistant chief in the beginning. And what Chief Williams found out is Parks was trying to undermine his leadership, and what resulted was Chief Williams demoting Chief Parks in 1994 from assistant chief back down to deputy chief.
Right.
Well, that created a major animosity, and eventually Parks was in charge of internal affairs. And a lot of this stuff was designed to make Chief Williams look bad, and if anybody is lucky enough to interview Chief Williams, he'll tell you. He settled...
Right. I'm not disputing that, and I think people should read the book to really get to the meat of that.
Context of White Supremacy. So that was Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, speaking with author Randall Sullivan, former LAPD officer Russell Poole. For folks who don't recall, former LAPD chief of police, Bernard Parks, is a black male. That's the person that you heard at the end where Russell Poole is saying that, hey, we got this Bernard Parks guy. He was deputy chief. He was trying to do all this to sabotage Chief Williams. And then he found out about it, so he demotes him. And then Bernard Parks, black male, goes to internal affairs, and he does all this trying to sabotage Chief Williams. All that stuff comes up about these different gangs and things operating in the 1990s. He was just Bernard Parks, this old black male, just making a... How many times does that charge get made in the book? I took many, many notes on that segment alone, just from that portion of kind of the tail end of that interview. Any of the folks who dialed in, anything that stood out from that snippet in context with what we've already heard, or comments you want to make on that before I get to my notes? Rob in California, yes, sir.
It was pretty interesting. It was almost laughable how he was stating like that Suge Knight was quote unquote hands off, saying that he was well connected and how powerful he was. Nugget of truth. When he said, and I think he almost slipped when he said this, but he was like, you know, Suge Knight only assaulted black people, you know what I'm saying? And then he was like, I thought he was about to say, because he know what would happen if he do something to a white person, but he said he know what, you know, he'll have like the national press on him if, you know, he touched somebody at Rolling Stone. And I thought that was very interesting. I thought it was almost a slip of the tongue, and I'll mute my line there. Thank you for listening.
Laughable would certainly be one accurate description. Any other thoughts from the interview? Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, Mr. Poole, Mr. Sullivan.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas, yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. I also, like the last caller, I found it humorous a little, but a little uncomforting at the same time. Just the the degree in which he spoke of how serious of a man Suge Knight was, you know, and how scary he was and how he was as untouchable as he was, which means that he, in my brain computer, if this person is untouchable and a black male and all of this and cops can't touch him, it's because they're told not to by a white person. Like, it just makes sense to me. Like, he's untouchable because he's a powerful black male. Where does he get his power from? Like it has to be like in with the way power works in my brain. Like it would have that the power that Suge Knight is harnessing and left him untouchable had to be inherited from someone white. He seems to be comfortable because he is white. You know, he didn't say he wouldn't attack a journalist. He specifically said a white journalist. It's laughable, and it's sad at the same time. Thank you. I'll leave my line.
Laughable and sad at the same time.
Hypocritical.
Lots of hypocrisy throughout the system of white supremacy. And indeed, almost a slip of the tongue, Suge Knight knows what will happen if he tries to pull this gangster rap stuff with a white person, even Vanilla Ice. Talk about hypocrisy. He seemed to be suggesting there that maybe that was all just rumor that Suge Knight, you know, roughed up old Vanilla Ice and made him. Maybe that was all just, you know, some good old rap tales that they fooled us all over the years. Now, back in the book, we read this. This is way back weeks ago. In the text, he said similar incidents were repeated on several occasions before Suge showed up at the white rapper's suite on the 15th floor of the Belle Age Hotel, accompanied by Chocolate, a rapper, and a member of the L.A. Raiders football team. No footnote. For several years, Vanilla Ice claimed that Suge and his companions drew guns to chase away two security guards, then pulled the white rapper out onto a balcony and threatened to throw him off unless he signed over the disputed song rights. Suge Knight denied this story, and so eventually did Vanilla Ice. But something happened in the room that convinced the white rapper to sign over rights to all seven songs free of charge. No footnote. He didn't quite sound like that in the interview. Hypocrisy. Let's see. I will get to my notes from chapter 11. This fella accumulated 900 hours of sick time. Wow. System of white supremacy. Non-white people, I think, generally have a more difficult time accumulating all that wonderful time for mental health. Also, he had access to a doctor who provided him with a diagnosis of job-related stress. Not upset about it, just saying sometimes it can be challenging for victims of racism to get access for someone to say, oh yeah, they are messing over you on the job. Let me get you bang, so you can take 5-6 months off to get your act together and get paid while you recuperate. Next, let's see. Poole says, while he's taking his sabbatical to think, I spent more time with my kids than I had since they were born. White people do not care about children. Actually, this reminded me of Chris Kyle, American Sniper, because he said the same thing. I'm out for my deployments, killing non-white people, shooting them down, bang, 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 all the rest of it. And then I come home, we don't have a deployment, kind of hang out, got this child crying, I haven't hung out with him and all the rest of it. Like, oh, I'm supposed to do, I like killing, I'll be here changing diapers, and even if it is my child. Let's see. Next. I think Henry in Chicago talked about Ralph Poole talking about his darkest hour. There it is again, with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. That's the same department that's having all the big brouhaha now. Sheriff Arpaio, I believe, in LA County, where they had lots of ongoing abuse of non-white people. Let's see. So he gets promoted to detective, and he caught a case where a deputy working by himself has killed someone unjustly. So he turns the case over. He said he had no choice but to make the arrest himself, Ralph Poole said, and to testify against the accused officer as the lead witness for the prosecution. All right. The day he arrived at the courthouse to take the stand, he got caught alone near an elevator, the elder Poole recalled, and was immediately surrounded by 7 or 8 friends of the defendant. Now, that's interesting right there, because he could have used a lot. Yahoos, ruffians, miscreants, rogue officers. Lots of different ways they could have been described, right? Friends of the defendant. They're just being loyal to a brother in blue. Told him he was being a rat, then began to close a circle around him. He would have taken a beating for sure, Ralph Poole said, if not for his veteran partner who showed up to stand beside him and convince the others they would be killing their own careers if they didn't back off right now. Now, we can pause right there. We've heard a lot of labeling of gangbangers and gangsters and all the rest of it. Like, I mean, are you serious? He said he was going to testify. He said he arrived at the courthouse and more than a half dozen officers, who we suspect are all white, showed up to beat his hind parts in the courthouse. If that doesn't qualify as gangster behavior, I don't know what it is. And I might not. I'm ignorant about a lot of things. So maybe I just don't understand gangster behavior. But that sounds like Godfather, right? Like Scarface. Like, have you rolling down the church steps, the courthouse steps? Like, hey, what do you mean going in here testifying, rat? You rat. Think we'll show you. Darkest hour indeed. Let's see. This reminded me of Chris Kyle, too. Heard this one a number of times from those white officers. Remember down in Texas, McKinney, Texas, close to Moen, Dallas, 2015, he threw the black female on the ground. I think he was a former military officer. Got all that pent up aggression. Look forward. We get to go out, get to use my nigger knocker, get to do a chase. Turn the siren on, drive 100 miles an hour and catch somebody. Beat down a non-white gangbanger. He says, as a probationer, you don't get to drive, so you're on the radio, but some of the partners I had were a lot more aggressive behind the wheel than others. Just going through an intersection with one of those guys was unbelievably scary because there was some really close calls. You can't understand the adrenaline pump you get when you're chasing armed felony suspects until you start to do it. It's indescribable, and it seems a lot of folks, they get addicted to that. Ooh, the excitement. Ooh, want to go to the area where they got the most excitement, where I get the most of these high-speed chases, get to get out, pull out my Glock, and shoot at a suspect. Yeah, as long as he's a Negro. Yeah, yeah. What does it mean to be white? Mark Furman. Let's see. The retired Superior Court judge who presided over. All right, so this is with the Kevin Gaines case where he, again, this no count Johnny Cochran, black leaders, no count Bernard, Bernard Parks at the time, make this settlement against Frank Liga for Gaines' family so they can get all this money, $250,000, I believe. And he said all these different folks were just disgusted, like, oh, I can't believe it. This ridiculous amount of money for this no-count maniac black officer, Kevin Gaines. Let's see. And then he says, Kenneth Hahn was a legendary figure in Los Angeles' black community, and justifiably so. Elder Hahn met with, had been the only white. Oh, wait a minute. So I think the Hahns are white. Now, this is important. I think one of the folks who was talking thought Kenneth Hahn was a black person. I think Kenneth Hahn is a white person. Let's read and make sure. Kenneth Hahn was a legendary figure in Los Angeles' black community, and justifiably so. In 1965, shortly after the Watts riots, the elder Hahn had been the only white politician in L.A. courageous enough to meet Martin Luther King Jr. at the airport when the civil rights leader arrived to survey the damage. His son, Jimmy, stood for nothing more than the advancement of his own career, but ever since entering politics, he had been dependent upon overwhelming support from the black community to win the election. Now, I think this is double here. I think this is racism, white supremacy. I don't know anything about either of the Hahn individuals. If they're classified as white, they're suspected racist. But it's disparaging. I think that might have been why someone may have thought that Kenneth Hahn, or excuse me, that the younger Hahn was a black person because of the way he's talked about. He's kind of described as a black person because apparently he depends on black voters for his political career. That's what, you know, that's why I highlighted this portion. It seemed like all the way around. And I think this younger Hahn, he could have been practicing racism because lots of white people love to manipulate black voters. Even our current president love to manipulate black voters. And, oh, I love me some niggers. Vote for me. I'm with you all. I got your back. My dad was with Dr. King. So that's classic. My dad marched with Dr. King and all the rest of that. Let's see. And he says that no count Johnny Cochran would pocket a third of the money from the Gaines settlement, but also could tell his supporters in South Central that he had stuck it to the mothers one more time. I said, what in the world? Did Johnny Cochran say that after the O.J. Simpson trial? That I stuck it to those mothers. Let me go down here so I can tell the brothers and sisters in South Central. I stuck it to the mother. Who says that? Does anybody say that? I feel like that's another one. That's right there with gangbanger and all that, because I feel like that's that racialized language. You don't hear white people say, I stuck it to the mother. Let's see. I think Randall Sullivan really hates Johnny Cochran. That comes through here like, wow. Let's see. The chief also made sure that Detective Russell Poole would not be on the witness stand telling people about the cross-pollination between the city's black gangs and its black police officers, and about how Chief Parks, also black, had stifled his investigation of the black cops who worked for Suge Knight and Death Row Records. Now, see, that's what I mean. It's just black people are the scourge of the earth. Everything that's wrong about all of this is black people. That no count Johnny Cochran, that no count Bernard Parks, that no count Suge Knight, that no count Maxine Waters, that no, just black people, black people, black people. They all suck. All of them. Every single one of them. They're all lame criminals, gangbangers, and all the like. Got it. Let's see. Parks goes in with Hahn and Cochran on a deal to pay off Gaines' family when they know that Gaines is a criminal, dirty cop, and a maniac. Pause right there. You're going to have to substantiate, homie. You're going to have to tell. Oh, man. This is just name calling and the way they can just throw around words. You're a drug dealer. You're a welfare queen. Miscreant. Gangbanger. Kevin Gaines is a maniac. Like, what? I think that can, being manic can't be a medical description to say someone is a maniac. Like, really? What do you mean exactly? Corey Bent attempted to set the record straight, telling reporters Frank Liga adamantly opposed the settlement. He wanted a trial. He wanted the truth to come out. Cochran and co-counsel Carl Douglas had no evidence against him despite all their efforts. I would have loved this case to go to trial too. Like, woo, let's see if we can get as much evidence as possible. Are there witnesses, or is all we're going to have on this is what Frank Liga said before he was recorded bragging about his love of killing black people? Probably wanted to shoot Johnny Cochran too. And then we got another one from the Word God. That was the good before Corey Brent, but Frank Liga still had a cloud hanging over him. Always something foreboding, vile, associated with darkness, blackness, or and or black people. Let's see. That Liga was Parks and Hahn in concert with Johnny Cochran, all black people except for Hahn, Negro associated. Maybe he's, what do they call it? Honorary Negro. This Mr. Hahn fella. Liga said, laid me out with Johnny Cochran. Liga said, laid me out as a racist killer, a reputation I still have to fight every single day, especially now since that recording came out in 2014. He did indeed. During the next 2 years, Liga would be named as a defendant in 22 Rampart-related lawsuits, even though he had never worked in that division. Like Poole, Liga was so infuriated to learn that the LAPD's task force had abandoned the theory that Ray Perez stole his cocaine in retaliation for the Gaines shooting. We already know that Perez called up Property Division and gave them the ID numbers for that dope that Liga booked into evidence. Maybe that happened. Maybe it didn't. But wow, this Frank Liga is, what did they say? No angel, the way that they talk about Negroes. Absolutely. So I absent to say this. Oh, we got another. Woe is Russell Poole, valiant officer fighting the good night fight. Woe is Frank Liga, valiant white officer who all these conniving scoundrel no-counts like Johnny Cochran just get to play as a racist, which is exactly what he sounds like on that recording that came out, what, almost 15 years after this book was published? Let's see. Rafael Perez knows for certain that if he rolls over on Mac and Knight, they will track him down and have him killed. Are you serious? Like, both of these folks were arrested shortly after the murders of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. Are they that well connected that they have criminal machinations even from greater confinement? Their tentacles reach out. And if that's the case, then I mean, wow, these folks need to be a Superman. The way they treated Geronimo Pratt, right? You know how to deal with real terrorist threats. We just heard about that. Put him next to Charles Manson, right? Rest in peace. You know how to deal with those folks, right? Let's see. Oh, we heard this. This is so, Zoom. Can't keep his pants zipped up. Jeffrey Toobin. So Jeffrey Toobin. He said, at one point during their deliberation of the David Mack trial, they say, at one point during their deliberations, 11 of the jurors signed a note sent to the judge in which they complained that the 12th member of the panel was refusing to discuss the evidence and had decided to vote not guilty before the trial began. To no one's surprise, this juror was black, and the other members of the panel, Hispanic, Asian, and white, wrote that they were being hung up by a race issue. Are you flipping? See, again, the only people who practice racism, the only people who really are a problem in this book, black people. Every time. Black police officers, black jurors, black police officers, Suge Knight, Johnny Cochran, Rodney King, O.J. Simpson, Maxine Waters, Tom Bradley. It just goes on and on and on and on. Bill Cosby, probably. Every single black person is a problem. And it's Cosby was in the book, too. He's probably a problem, too. Every single black person is a problem and practicing racism, even against other black people, it seems. Let's see. Oh, I didn't even get my notes from the recording. Maybe I'll get in one or two from those really quick before we get out. Just from the recording that we heard with David D., Suge Knight has a key to the city. Metaphor, are you serious? A Negro has the key to the plantation? Are you serious? DA, he said a district attorney was connected with Suge Knight in Los Angeles, and that's what kept Suge Knight out of trouble. Again, I thought Suge Knight was arrested, parole violation in 1996, right after Tupac Shakur was assassinated. Maybe I'm mistaken about that. It seems if I got friends, that is not going to happen. It's not going to ever be no Suge Knight violating a parole violation because everyone is shook. They are afraid of me. Let's see. The phrase, the information I received, that right there, talk about language, that is the most vague nonsense. You are making something sound offensive when you could be talking absolute information I received from the bathroom stall. The information I received from the neighborhood crackhead. The information I received from the back of a discarded lottery ticket. The information I received from police informant Julio Butler. You don't even describe where you got this information from, just the information I received. Even that, to call it information, like, what? Is this accurate information? Is this misinformation? Is this deliberate disinformation? It was said repeatedly. He said it at least three times. Russell Poole did. Let's see. And that Suge Knight's friends with the former mayor of Las Vegas as well. Again, how did he not end up? How did he end up in greater confinement if he has all these homies and buddies in political offices? Let's see. Blames it all on O.J. Simpson and Rodney King. This era of racism in the mid-90s, nobody wanted to have a big scandal involving black officers. At minimum, everybody failed, if that's the case, because Rafael Perez is known. Maybe everybody listening to this broadcast doesn't know him. This is all kind of old stuff now anyway, 20 years, 25 years ago. But I mean, Rafael Perez is one of the most well-known rogue cops in the country's history, in California history, right up there with Mark Furman. They got movies. He's got a Wikipedia page, all of the above. If the goal was to hush this down so these black officers don't look like gangsters and criminals, everybody failed in that effort. Let's see. He said they were killing people every day. He made it sound like he said that he had a list of over 1,500 unsolved murders. Did Suge Knight kill all of those people? All that is death row fatalities? Like, are you? Let's see. Law enforcement is afraid of Suge Knight. That one is another one. Are you going to tell me someone who ended up in greater confinement days after Tupac Shakur was assassinated, how did he end up in confinement if they were afraid of him? Did they have to bring out the military? Nuclear armament? Drones? You know, maybe they had an early prototype circa 1996. How did they ever get him handcuffed? Get out of here. And then, yeah, he gets to the end. They're all afraid, but there's no record of him attacking white people. Why would white people be afraid of a black person when there's no record of him attacking white people? Except for Vanilla Ice. And I guess that's tenuous. Doesn't even make sense. Like, I felt like both Poole and Sullivan, I felt like they were spinning so much nonsense. It was even difficult for them. That's why he had to say, well, you know, it would be really bad if I was a black person because you know she'll go after some niggers. You know he go after you coons, don't he? Get out of here. Same guy who said menstrual show, Randall Sullivan. Same guy who said Biggie looked like he came out of a menstrual show. Back to the book. Anything else I need to get in before we get to audio segment two? Murders don't go unsolved when the victim is a celebrity who gets shot dead in the street in front of a dozen witnesses who can identify the killers, Poole answered. Remind me of any recent cases where that has happened other than Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls. Murders like that only go unsolved if the police don't want to solve them. Agreed, but I mean, this sort of thing happens all the time in the system of racism, white supremacy. They get cases of black people being killed on camera, race soldiers, badger, no, all the time. Even some white people, all the time. System of white supremacy demands killing, so sometimes we make an effort to find the killer. Oftentimes, we do not. Gonna have some killing. What are you gonna do? Let's see. Anything else? Let's see. I was just talking about this with someone this week, that in this text, Randall Sullivan portrays the Nation of Islam as a gang. He talked about how many of the people who join the Nation of Islam join from prison. Almost seems like if you're a black male with a bow tie, Nation of Islam and a gangbanger. That's the way he talks about Amir Muhammad throughout the text. Says the Times article, this is chapter 12, was vague about what police had done to pursue the theory that Amir Muhammad was the killer of Biggie Smalls, describing Muhammad as a shadowy figure. That's in the word got too shadowy, same pattern. Figure who was impossible to locate. Detectives searched for Muhammad, but many of the addresses that came up in the background check were either false or led to post office boxes. Now, again, they found him later on. So could you find him or can you not find him? you really want to find him, I think you could find him. Seems like most of the other non-white people on the planet, you really want to find them, you track them down, especially if they're in the continental U.S. Let's see. The paper then leveled the inevitable charge of racism, quoting unnamed cynics inside the paper who believed the Times would never have embraced such flimsy evidence if the target had been a prominent white businessman talking about Amir Muhammad instead of a Nation of Islam member. I don't even know if Amir Muhammad is in the Nation of Islam. Like, does someone remember? I have to look myself. I don't remember Amir Muhammad even saying that he was in the Nation of Islam. Like, is all this just based on him having a bow tie? Like, I know he said he's a mortgage broker, but did he say, oh, yes, and I'm also black Muslim, Nation of Islam member, you know, all of that, like... I have to double check to make sure I'm not, you know, in error. And I would agree with that as well. Generally speaking, white people don't get hemmed up on flimsy evidence. I think O.J. Simpson, same thing. Brian S. Bentley said that they had no evidence. And a number of other people said that they had no evidence for a case. Even Johnny Cochran said that you have no evidence for a case against Mr. Simpson. Thus, he's acquitted. No evidence against Amir Muhammad. Frankly, no evidence against anyone that they have presented. Not Suge Knight, not David Mack. No one. That's why nobody's been arrested, in my opinion. Let's see. Oh, and then Amir Muhammad could not be a murderer because he was a mortgage broker. David Mack had been cleared as a suspect in the murder of Biggie Smalls because the LAPD said wasn't investigating that possibility, and that the only reason these two had been singled out for membership was that they were black. That's the contention, or rather, I guess, the story, or people fussing at the LA Times for this position. Frankly, if all you had was, we got a white fellow wearing a bow tie at the scene of the Biggie Smalls murder, and that's it, yeah, I do think it would have been that different. They probably wouldn't have been the story. We probably wouldn't know Amir Muhammad's name. You would need way more evidence than we got some shadowy-looking white man in a suit with a bow tie standing around Biggie Smalls. Maybe he was in the Fruit of Islam. I don't think that would happen. Anything else I need to get in? Yeah, I can stop there. Anything else folks need to get in before we get to audio segment two, or be straight?
Yes, I want to apologize for identifying James Hahn as a black person. That was me that did that. But what's also interesting is James Hahn became mayor of L.A., and before that was Richard Reardon, who was basically the mayor of L.A. during this whole investigation, and when Russell Poole was investigating, but he was also the one who appointed Parks as the chief of police. But what's also more interesting is Reardon's name is never mentioned in the book, but Tom Bradley's name is, and also James Hahn's name is mentioned in the book negatively, but no mention of Mayor Reardon in the book. That's all I have. I mean, my life.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Again, it's only bad people who are to blame, culprits, if you will. Even with Mr. Hahn, though, was that logical? What I was saying, like, I could see how someone would think, oh, this Mr. Hahn must be a black guy, too, because he gets kind of racialized as an honorary Negro. Like, he's just hanging out and getting all his black lackeys to vote for him so that he could be some political power broker in L.A. Did that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right on. Any other commentary folks need to get in?
I got a couple of things. Now, you heard?
Yes, sir. Rob in California.
When he was talking about Mr. Hahn, his name is, he spoke about him running for election and that he used his wife's money to run for election. That stood out to me. I didn't think that point was relevant. And when he was describing the assassination of Tupac Shakur, and he was stating that Suge Knight was behind it, it read like the autobiography of Malcolm X. when he was assassinated, and they were it was stated that, you know, the Nation of Islam was behind the assassination when it was other culprits. That it seemed very similar to me. It read very similar, and that's all I have right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Rob, in California. I would agree. Lots of similarities in how you can have bad things happen, mistreatment, even killings happen to non-white people, where non-white people may be involved, but the people who are most to blame get to hide all the time, and they are classified as white. Happens very regularly. They are expert at those type of situations. I did just two other quick things I wanted to get in. Briefly, they mentioned Bill Hodgman, William Hodgman, O.J. Simpson. They didn't, I think they kind of left out. He was the one who had the heart attack at the early portion of the trial and ended up no longer participating. I think Bill Hodgman now is the O.J. Simpson trial. Yes, he's affiliated with that. They talked to him for all the anniversaries and blah, blah, blah. Also, though, sex abuse, because remember, I just said Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom, can't keep his pants up, sexual abuse, that's throughout the book, anal sodomy, all throughout here. Bill Hodgman is now known for doing lots with Catholic Church and sexual abuse in Southern California and trying to bring people to have them criminally prosecuted, even if these crimes happened a long time ago. Like, he's done apparently a lot of constructive with work with that, because there's so much of that child rape in the system of white supremacy. What do you say? White people don't care about children. Let's see, was the other quick comment I want to make sure I got in, or last one from the, oh yeah, he says, how many innocent people are in prison because of false testimony by Los Angeles police officers, asked USC law professor Owen Chemerinsky in the first sentence of a commentary published by the Los Angeles Times in December 1999. The answer was that there was no way of knowing, since the only LAPD officer proven to have perjured himself in court was Rafael Perez, upon whose allegations Chemerinsky's question was based. This book was published this millennia. So we know this statement is false, because an LAPD officer was convicted of perjury in 1995. So Ray Perez is not the only LAPD officer to perjure himself. Not at all. To have proven, like, get out of here. Like, that's just false. And in my view, and it's not just, that's not just an indictment of Randall Sullivan for writing something that, I mean, hey, you know O.J. Simpson, you know Mark Furman, so you know Rafael Perez is not the only LAPD officer to perjure himself in court. You know all this. This book was edited. That means you had a whole lot of white people who read this, and nobody, hey, Rush, you're going kind of tough on the niggers in this book. We get it. Everybody hates Johnny Cochran and blah, 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 but I mean, hey, Rafael Perez is not the only officer to perjure himself. Like, reword it, blah, blah, blah. Let's come, not, we don't have to come out and just make up total lies. Like, we do remember Mark Furman. Anywho, audio segment number two. If you have thoughts you didn't get to share, make a note. We'll only have one more section left after this week. So, getting close to the conclusion. Labyrinth, Randall Sullivan, Context of White Supremacy.
It was unlikely, anyway, that the Los Angeles Police Commission would restore credibility to the LAPD, at least not as long as its president was Gerald Shalhoub, a former defense attorney who only a few months earlier had remarked during a news conference that all cops are liars. Shalhoub was a major supporter of the consent decree proposed by Bill Lan Lee, the chief of the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, who, in May of 2000, threatened Los Angeles with a practice and pattern civil lawsuit unless the city agreed to give control of the LAPD to federal auditors. In September of 2000, the Los Angeles City Council voted 12-3 to accept the consent decree. "We all felt we needed all the help we could get reforming the LAPD," explained Jackie Goldberg. City Attorney James Hahn, still the city's leading candidate for mayor, avoided the subject of the consent decree as long as possible, but was compelled during an appearance before the city council to answer a question about whether the city could be sued by the federal government if Los Angeles's powerful employee unions failed to abide by it. "We feel that what we are proposing is something we should be able to reach agreement on, if we roll up our sleeves and really work at it," was Hahn's non-answer. Los Angeles apparently was going to get the leader it deserved. For most of LA's interested parties, the real question had become how much this scandal was going to end up costing. The city's loosest canon, civil rights attorney Stephen Yagman, had obtained from the LAPD a list of 9,845 cases involving 27 Rampart officers implicated in wrongdoing by Rafael Perez. And by the end of 2000, he had filed nearly 200 lawsuits in federal court. The Times quoted legal experts who warned that the cost of settling the pending lawsuits against the LAPD would be significantly more than the $125 million projected by James Hahn. The cost certainly would be more if Johnny Cochran had anything to say about it. In February of 2000, Cochran had hosted a meeting of more than two dozen civil rights attorneys to discuss coordinating lawsuits, telling reporters afterward, "If we band together, we can get a lot done." In light of the $15 million settlement paid by the city to Javier Ovando, it looked as if a lot would be done, whether the lawyers worked together or not. By the spring of that year, either damage control or exploitation of the scandal had become the tactic of almost every important political figure in Los Angeles. Chief Parks and District Attorney Gil Garcetti, each of whom had been pointing his finger at the other in private for months, let their feud break into the open during March of 2000. Parks took the first swing, issuing an order to his detectives that they were to deny prosecutors access to any information regarding the Rampart investigation. Garcetti had given him bad legal advice, Parks said, was dragging his feet about prosecuting the cases already delivered to his office, and no longer could be trusted. Garcetti struck back 2 weeks later with an offer of amnesty to LAPD whistleblowers, an idea Parks already had rejected when it was proposed by the Police Protective League. For Russell Poole, the final straw was Parks' criticism of Garcetti for not filing charges against Brian Hewitt in the beating of Ismael Jimenez. Parks and the LAPD never wanted Garcetti to file charges in that case and were happy when he didn't, a seething Poole said. Now they want to blame the DA for not filing. I know for certain that Garcetti didn't have all the information he should have had because Chief Parks kept it from him. Poole had spent the past year living in two parallel worlds. On the one hand, he spent more time with his wife and children than he had allowed himself to during his entire career as an LAPD detective. Poole also had launched a business that helped high school athletes obtain college scholarships. He was free to visit his parents at their home in Palm Springs and to coach his children's baseball and softball teams. My life was better, Poole said, but I couldn't have peace as long as I thought I had let Chief Parks get away with what he did during that last year and a half I was on the department. The more he thought about how the LAPD brass had treated him, the angrier Poole became. He had heard some of what was being whispered about him at Parker Center, suggestions that he was an emotionally unstable troublemaker who had betrayed his loyalty to the LAPD by going over the heads of his supervisors to the district attorney's office. Brian Tyndall advised Poole that his letter of resignation had circulated in photocopy throughout the robbery homicide division, even though it was supposed to be a confidential document. Poole knew that his final performance evaluation report was being withheld so that the LAPD wouldn't have to explain what his problems were, especially in the light of an outstanding past record. The last evaluation Poole had received from the Robbery Homicide Division in October of 1997 was the most vague and elliptical he had ever seen. He had been rated strong, the LAPD's highest rating, in each of the 17 areas in which officers were evaluated, Poole noted, except one. The box labeled Judgment and Common Sense had been left blank. The same commanders and chiefs who suggested he was not right in the head, however, had asked for Poole's help when it became apparent that the LAPD's internal prosecution of Brian Hewitt and Ethan Cohan was going to fail. In June 1999, Poole had been subpoenaed at the last minute to appear at the departmental trial board hearing, where his testimony resulted in the dismissal of Hewitt and Cohan from the LAPD. "Apparently, when they needed me, I was no longer a nutcase, he observed. Ultimately, it was not being able to sleep at night that drove Poole to act. I decided I had to get the truth out in the one way that was left to me, he explained. On September 26, 2000, 11 months after resigning from the LAPD, Poole filed a civil lawsuit naming Chief Bernard Parks, the Los Angeles Police Department, and the City of Los Angeles as defendants. The suit specifically accused Parks of violating his First Amendment right to go public after Poole began to uncover evidence suggesting the involvement of other LAPD officers in criminal activity. Chief Parks responded with a press release in which he described Poole's claims as totally false. He could not comment on any specific allegations by former Detective Poole, Parks explained, but then did, chiding Poole for his failure to make his complaints known at the time they occurred, and asserting that Poole's 40-page report on a scandal in the making had not been discarded or ignored, but rather was edited of all conjectural materials. Interestingly, Chief Parks referred repeatedly to Poole's work on the Rampart Task Force, without once mentioning what the group had been called back when Poole was assigned to it. Chief Parks turned the Robbery-Homicide Task Force into the Rampart Task Force in order to cover up all that had led up to the arrest of Perez, Poole said, and because of my lawsuit, he's going to have to explain why he did that. That's what scares him. It was a favor of fortune that Poole's claim against the LAPD had been filed just as a number of people in Los Angeles noticed that the empire of lawsuits, suspensions, and scandals built on the word of Rafael Perez was beginning to crumble all around them. The first crack in the facade of repentance that Perez had constructed around him appeared in February of 2000, when the Los Angeles Times finally reported that the ex-officer-turned-informant has failed a polygraph test. Actually, it was five polygraph tests that Perez had failed 5 months earlier. The Times' understatement was buried deep inside a story that ran under the headline, Police in Secret Group Broke Law Routinely, transcripts say. But nevertheless, a lot of readers found it the most significant revelation in weeks. Gradually, an assortment of other facts began to undermine the ex-officer-turned-informant's credibility. Perez's own admission that he had lied thousands of times under oath in court, and that he had done so quite convincingly, finally began to make at least a few observers wonder why they should believe anything he said now. So did the news that he had cheated on his wife so routinely that he couldn't remember his girlfriend's names unless investigators showed him photographs. Perez even had lied on his marriage license, it was discovered, swearing that Denise Perez was his first wife. Perez was essentially a chameleon, an LAPD officer who had worked with him at Rampart Division explained to reporters. When he wanted to be Latino, he was Rafael. When he wanted to be black, he was Rafe. The LAPD detectives who had interrogated him all said Perez asked them to address him as Ray. Most tellingly, though, a close examination of Perez's confessions revealed that by far the most despicable crimes he described had been committed by himself and by his partner, Nino Durden. Most of his other allegations amounted to stuff you could watch Andy Sipowicz doing any Tuesday night on NYPD Blue. The inconsistencies in Perez's story emerged slowly. First, an LAPD search for the crash pad apartment in the San Fernando Valley that Rampart officers supposedly had used for their debaucheries ended in failure, convincing investigators assigned to the case that Perez had invented the story. He couldn't recall the address of the apartment, Perez explained, or the street, or even the neighborhood. He did recall attending a drunken party at which Officer Kulin Patel had been present, Perez said, and even was able to provide a date. But when Patel's attorney produced photographs and documents that utterly refuted Perez's story, the LAPD's charges against Patel were withdrawn. All this proves is that he's human, said Winston K. McKesson. What it proved was that he couldn't be trusted. That became even more evident when Perez appeared at an LAPD trial board to testify against former Rampart Division colleague Lawrence Martinez, whom he had accused of helping to frame two 18th Street gang members on gun charges in April 1996. Perez testified under oath that the arrest was initiated by his meeting with a police informant on April 2nd of that year. When Perez named the informant, Martinez's attorney, Darryl Mounger, promptly demonstrated that the man had been incarcerated on April 2, 1996, and could not possibly have met with Perez on that date. "I caught him with his pants down," Maunger said of Perez. "The problem with Perez," the attorney added, "is that he's told so many lies that he's confused. He doesn't know what the truth is anymore." Winston McKesson conceded that Perez had erred, but once again defended his client's integrity. "He believes the informant is who he said it was," McKesson explained. "That's still who he pictures in his mind. But the identity of the informant is not what he considered important about this case." Chief Parks and his right-hand man, Lieutenant Emmanuel Hernandez, both told reporters that 70 to 80% of what Perez had claimed in his confessions had been verified by LAPD investigators. Neither Parks nor Hernandez would provide any specifics, however, and their claims were hardly backed up by the performance of Perez as a witness against his fellow officers. Far later than it should have, and with considerably less prominence than the news merited, the Los Angeles Times reported that only 3 of the 14 LAPD officers brought before trial boards in connection to the Rampart scandal had been dismissed from the department. What the Times did not mention was that one of those fired was Perez's former partner, Nino Durden, and that the other 2 were Brian Hewitt and Ethan Cohen, both of whom had been convicted not on the basis of Perez's allegations against them, but by the testimony of Russell Poole. All 11 of the officers subjected to trial boards in which the main witness against them was Rafael Perez had been exonerated. Finally, despite knowing it would essentially kill his career, at least as long as Bernard Parks or anyone associated with him ran the LAPD, Captain Roger K. Combs, who had presided over one of these trial boards, told the Times, "Perez has not shown himself to be a credible witness." Many LAPD officers could scarcely restrain their cheers. "Combs may have hurt himself in the short run," said Police Protective League Vice President Bob Baker, "but most of the rank and file consider him a hero." Los Angeles County District Attorney Gil Garcetti described Perez's problems as a witness in rather less ambiguous terms. "He's a liar," Garcetti said. "He tells the truth, too. But can you tell when he's telling the truth and when he's not telling the truth?" The short answer was no, and the enormity of the problem this created was just beginning to register with the powers that be. The Los Angeles media, political establishment, and legal system had all committed themselves to what the Times now called the admissions and allegations of Rafael Perez. Dozens of convicts had been released, hundreds of lawsuits had been filed, millions of dollars had been paid, and countless pages of newsprint had been invested in the claims of a man who didn't deserve to be believed about anything. A large part of the problem was that the media's coverage from the first had been driven more by ideology than by information. The Times, the LA Weekly, and the New Times all persisted in describing Perez as Hispanic, even though he was half black. His own attorney had explained to them that Puerto Rican culture is much closer to African American than to Hispanic, and that's why his closest friends were black. The Times had abandoned the link between Perez and David Mack, and between David Mack and Suge Knight, as soon as the Chuck Phillips story on Amir Muhammad was published, while both the Weekly and the New Times had rejected the Mack-Muhammad theory without any investigation of it. By far the most notable fact about the filing of Russell Poole's lawsuit against the LAPD was that the Los Angeles Times had declined to publish any serious investigation of the former detective's claims. Poole's explanation for this carried truly dangerous implications. During the summer of 2000, Poole recalled, he had a series of conversations with Leighton Glover about his belief that Chief Parks had obstructed justice. "At first I said I didn't trust them," Poole said, "but then I agreed to cooperate if they told the story right this time." But the article I was expecting never ran. "Finally, I called them up to ask why. Scott Glover told me they had been getting pressure from upstairs. When I asked what that meant, he said the publisher had made it clear that the Los Angeles Times was not going to help bring down an African-American chief of police." Scott Glover and Matt Lade, along with their editor Jim Newton, all disputed Poole's claim. However, Deputy District Attorney George Castillo, now assigned to the Belmont Task Force that was investigating LA's latest racially charged scandal, said he believed Russell Poole and not the newspaper reporters. "I believe the Times refused to report this story because they're cowards," Castillo explained. "I've said that to the faces of Matt Lade and Scott Glover, and they've come up with the sort of whiny excuses that lead me to believe they probably said what Russ says they said. It's obvious to everyone that this is what's going on here. It's certainly the consensus of opinion within the Belmont Task Force. Jan Golub, the freelance journalist whose reporting on Poole's lawsuit had made him a voice crying in the wilderness, agreed with Castillo completely. The Times and the rest of the media in Los Angeles have ignored Russell Poole for one reason. Liberal racism, Golub said. You can't tell a story in which the good guy is a white detective and the villains are all black. That isn't allowed, even if it's true. Golub, who found it difficult to sell his account of Poole's resignation from the LAPD, although Salon.com eventually did publish it online, was plagued by the unwillingness of those he interviewed to be identified by name. A knowledgeable source in the Los Angeles legal community had described Poole's lawsuit to Golub as a mine in the water, while a Los Angeles County official who asked for immunity told the reporter that because of Poole's lawsuit, serious charges could result, including indictments for obstruction of justice. His sources had all been afraid, Golub said, that the truth will never come out because neither the media nor the politicians want it to, and that they'll be left holding the bag. Some significant local figures were willing to speak in their own names on Poole's behalf, however. One was retired LAPD Deputy Chief Steve Downing, who described Poole's allegations to Golub as appalling, then added, "Anytime you have leads in a case pointing to a cop, it's even more important that it be pursued to the absolute end. And you also have to ask the question, who else is involved? Have any other officers been infected by these activities?" What Bernard Parks had done to Russell Poole's investigative reports was an outrage, Downing later told Rolling Stone magazine. The police chief's job is to produce the truth, not bury it. Sergio Robleto, Poole's former lieutenant in South Bureau Homicide, was a man who many of his fellow officers had believed would one day become Los Angeles's first Hispanic chief of police, until he resigned from the LAPD to take a job as an executive at the corporate CIA, Kroll Associates. If Bernard Parks imagined he could discredit Russell Poole, Robleto warned, the chief had better think again. Poole was among the most honest and industrious police officers he had ever worked with, said Robleto, and possibly the most thorough detective he'd ever encountered. Everything Poole does, he writes down, explained Robleto, scoffing at the suggestion that Poole might have exaggerated what took place in his meetings with Chief Parks and other high-ranking officers. You're never going to catch Russ lying. Proving that Rafael Perez was not a credible witness, meanwhile, was becoming easier by the week. On September 26, 2000, the same day Russell Poole filed his lawsuit, the Los Angeles Times reported that a jailhouse informant said he had heard the ex-officer boast about being able to destroy anyone who crossed him. While he listened from the next cell, the man had told investigators from the Rampart Task Force, Perez bragged to his bunkmate, "If someone pisses me off, I'll throw their name into a hat and they'll get investigated, innocent or not." The informant was an ex-LAPD officer named Hank Rodriguez, who had been fired from the department in 1974. Rodriguez had been placed in the cell next to Perez's when he was arrested for a parole violation stemming from a drunk driving conviction. He observed that Perez had adopted a gang member type of attitude while in custody, Rodriguez said, flaunting his impunity with claims of book and movie deals and regularly breaking into rap songs. Part of what made Rodriguez's claims newsworthy was that the LAPD had managed to misplace them for 5 months after they were made. This was explained to the Los Angeles County Superior Court by Dan Schatz, the LAPD commander whom Russell Poole blamed more than any other high-ranking officer, other than Bernard Parks, for the suppression of his investigations during 1997 and 1998. What Schatz called an accident, the Times described as a potentially serious oversight that could affect any court cases in which Perez was called to the stand as a witness. "We're not done yet," Poole said. That much, at least, was certain.
Context of white supremacy. So we'll have one more session next week, be our final installment on Labyrinth, and then pushing off new book. Man, if Mel has time, I would be so excited if we can read Shaft. We wouldn't be starting next week, but Earl Tidyman, Shaft. Whew. But we'll have to see, because Gusty is not reading it, so yeah. We'll have to see what will be our next text, but not starting in next week. We'll wrap this up for next week. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. One of our investors wrote in for Chapter 12. I said, number one, the Times, the LA Weekly, and the New Times all persisted in describing Perez as Hispanic, even though he was half black. His own attorney had explained to them that Puerto Rican culture is much closer to African American than to Hispanic, and that's why his closest friends were black. The author seems fixated on Perez's ethnicity and race. What is African American culture? What is Puerto Rican culture? What is the difference between the two? What is Hispanic culture? What is the difference between the three? Racist man and racist woman are experts in causing confusion with these racial classifications. Again, the only race, the white race. Masters of confusion. Number two, Jan Golub, the freelance journalist, the Times, and the rest of the media in Los Angeles have ignored Russell Poole for one reason. Liberal racism, Golub said. You can't tell a story in which the good guy is a white detective and the villains are all black. I think somebody already said that. I said everybody that's bad who did something wrong, the villains are all black. Just get to repeat myself. I am going to need a definition of liberal racism. Yeah, I don't know what that is either. This statement is the epitome of irony. This book is nothing but a story about a good white guy and the villains are all black. That is a great summation. That basically is about the size of it. That's what this book is about. We got the virtuous good white guy, good old Russell Poole, and all these nefarious, no-count, corrupt, gang-banging Nation of Islam black people. And Johnny Cochran. And watch City of Lies. Yes. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Do not wait till the last moment if you have questions, comments to share. Any of the folks, line hand up, comments you would like to make on the second audio segment. We got Henry in Chicago, Rob in California, Mo in Dallas, Nab other folks as I see them.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Very quickly, in agreement with the person that wrote in, the investor that wrote in, it's just highlighting how good Russell Poole, how good the guy he is, and then just bad talking to all the black people, making them seem like superhuman Negroes almost. So I have a question. In the first audio segment, did the author state that what was the detective's name? I can't call his name, but the one who they're questioning whether he's Puerto Rican or black. Did the author state that he was the worst detective in LAPD history? And that's all I had, and I mean my life.
I think you're talking about Rafael Perez, and I believe that was in the early part of like chapter 12, where he was talking about Rafael Perez is the only officer in LAPD history who I think committed perjury or something of that nature, I think it was, that I was making a point about. He was saying Officer Perez is the only... Oh, this is it. Here we go. So he said the... Make sure we get the... All right. How many innocent people are in prison because of the false testimony by Los Angeles police officers, which is something Brian S. Bentley said they were trained to do by district attorneys to lie professionally? Asked USC law professor Erwin Chemerinsky in the first sentence of a commentary published by the LA Times in December 1999. The answer was that there was no way of knowing, since the only LAPD officer proven to have perjured himself in court was Rafael Perez, upon whose allegations Chemerinsky's question was based. So, again, this insistence that this Perez guy is the worst and perjurer and all the rest of it. Let's see. Henry in Chicago, thank you for your patience, sir.
All right. Once again, the author is basically moving Perez away from Hispanic towards Black. The one thing he says that the Times, the LA Weekly, and the New Times all persisted by describing Perez as Hispanic, even though he was half Black. His own attorney had explained to them that Puerto Rican culture is much closer to African-American than to Hispanic, and that's why his closest friends were Black. He is just making an overbearing effort to associate Perez as just Black, nothing else. He's not Puerto Rican. He's not Hispanic. He's not none of that stuff. He is 100% Black. And this is why he is being called the worst detective of all time, or police officer, and just, you know, all kind of crazy names that the author and Russell Poole is trying to pin on this guy. I laughed when they got the information about Perez from a quote unquote jailhouse informant named Hank Rodriguez, who is a disgraced LAPD officer in jail for violating the parole, who basically overheard Perez saying, if someone pisses me off, I'll throw their name into a hat and they'll get investigated, innocent or not. Oh, my God. Yeah, that sounds like I'm surprised it didn't get girl quotes from Suge Knight while he was in jail talking about, yeah, we got Biggie. We finally got him. And they could get these quotes from Perez in jail talking about they could throw their name into a hat and, you know, they'll get investigated. And, you know, what I had said in the last recording is Reardon's lack of mention in this story or in this book. And what's so interesting is I pulled up an article from the Los Angeles Times from 2000 titled Rampart Scandal Isolates Reardon. And basically the article just kind of goes into how Mayor Richard Reardon is part of this whole Rampart scandal. But yet the author never mentions Reardon in the book. So, but that's all I have on my line.
Very important. And I see there, blame it all on all the Black people. It's all their fault. That Tom Bradley, no count Bradley, Mayor Bradley, and no count Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and all these Black people, no count Bernard Parks, former chief of police. All these folks are to blame. And then leaving out, oh, no. Mr. Reardon didn't have anything to do with that. Not at all. My name not even mentioned, just like with David Kenner. I think Henry in Chicago had said that before. He was taking it easy on David Kenner, taking it easy on Mayor Reardon as well. Let's see. Any other folks commentary they want to make sure they get in? Grant, let's see. Notes that I had. Gil Garcetti has popped up in all three books that we read. O.J. Simpson, he was right there. Last book didn't want to release Geronimo Pratt. And then this time around, Gil Garcetti is the one going back and forth allegedly with Chief Bernard Parks about who is to blame for all of this. I'd say by the spring of that year, either damage control or exploitation of the scandal had become the tactic of almost every important political figure in Los Angeles. Chief Parks and District Attorney Gil Garcetti, each of whom had been pointing his finger at the other in private for months, let their feud break into the open during March of 2000. Who's to blame? The Negro. Parks took the first swing, issuing an order to his detectives that they were to deny prosecutors access to any information regarding the Rampart investigation. Then he goes on from there. I know for certain that Garcetti didn't have all the information he should have because Chief Parks kept it from him. That's why they couldn't get charges against Brian Hewitt in the beating of Ismael Jimenez. Black people are to blame for everything. Let's see. Then he says, my life was better, Poole says, but I couldn't have peace as long as I thought I had let Chief Parks get away with what he did during the last year and a half I was on the department. Everything is black people. I can't have peace in my life. I'm spending more time with my children and my wife, and I resigned from the department so I could just move on with it. No. Gotta get that Negro. Let's see. They go back to the polygraph test. I feel like we started out with that with O.J. Simpson. You know, he failed those polygraph tests. Polygraph tests aren't admitted in court for a reason. The same reason. Sometimes if they don't give a search warrant, it's because you don't have evidence. They don't admit polygraphs in court because they're not reliable. Not that I'm saying Rafael Perez is an honest fella, not saying that at all. Now, we continue with Rafael Perez, man not, and the fungibility. We're talking about of non-white males, black males in particular. News that Perez had cheated on his wife so routinely that he couldn't remember his girlfriend's names unless investigators showed him photographs. Again, this, in my view, is like that the Negro and their penis, right? Just the promiscuity of the black male long on the plantation. He continues, Perez even had lied on his marriage license. It was discovered. Swearing that Denise Perez was his first wife, same thing, can't even remember what I've done with my penis. Perez was essentially a chameleon, which would again be, that's like snake phallic thing and changing. He's not a human. That was the main reason. Man, not a person, being described as an animal, a beast. They said last week he's a shapeshifter, which is also not a person. That's generally, you're talking about an alien or something like that. Now he's some sort of reptilian creature or what have you. An LAPD officer who had worked with him at Rampart Division explained to reporters, when he wanted to be Latino, he was Rafael. When he wanted to be black, he was Rafe. The LAPD detectives who interrogated him all said Perez asked them to address him as Ray. Which one is that? Is that the mixed race one? Most tellingly, though, a close examination of Perez's confessions revealed that by far the most despicable crimes he described had been committed by himself and his partner, Nino Durden. They don't give enough information on him, maybe not a white person, but that I totally agree. It seems like some sort of fixation on Perez's racial classification almost seems like that deceptive nature. I think they had talked about before, like white people would sometimes have a particular spite if it's a non-white person who could confuse them about their racial classification, maybe even pass for white. I don't think Perez could pass for white, but just something about, oh my goodness, this Negro can speak Spanish and he's Puerto Rican and he looks good, and some nature of that homoerotic attraction there as well, and focusing on the genitalia with Mr. Perez. Lots to ponder on. The Shaft, Earl Tidyman. Let's see. Oh, and then it came right back. What I just said, focusing on the genitals, phallic symbol. Would it come right back on the same page? I just had to drop down on my very next footnote. That became even more evident when Perez appeared at an LAPD trial board to testify against former Rampart Division colleague Lawrence Martinez, whom he accused of helping to frame two 18th Street gang members on gun charges in April 1996. Perez testified under oath that the arrest was initiated by his meeting with a police informant on April 2nd of that year. When Perez named the informant, Martinez's attorney, Daryl Munger, promptly demonstrated that the man had been incarcerated on April 2, 1996 and could not possibly have met with Perez on that date. I caught him with his pants down, Monger said of Perez. Now, that's not even Sullivan writing, because this is a direct quote, but I mean, you pull that in, it's right in the same pattern. Focusing on the genitals, that's the metaphor we pick. Caught him with his pants down, genitals exposed. Chameleon exposed, if you will. Let's see. The Times, LA Weekly, and the New York Times all persisted in describing Perez as Hispanic, even though he was half black. All that, what does all that mean? Why is this the focus so much of it here? Like I said, I'm not even disputing that, you know, this person may not be telling the truth all the time and all the rest of it. That's the system of white supremacy. But just, wow, so much of it, the genitals and the racial ambiguity of his, conduct, perhaps. Let's see. And then this, when I asked what that means, and he says that the LA Times reporters told him they're not going to help bring down an African-American chief of police. I don't know what liberal racism is, but I mean, I see all kinds of reports all the time where all types of people have no compunction or hesitancy about saying something bad about a black person, even when it was a black president. In fact, more people rejoice then about talking bad about black people than at any other time. I don't remember that logic kicking in full force, like, oh, wait a minute, we got that old teaspoon of liberal racism, we can't say anything bad, we don't want to be a party to bring it down the first Negro president. That's not how they behaved at all with Barack Obama. At no point, not even for the first week, it wasn't like that. We didn't want to help bring down old Chief Parks because he's the first Negro sergeant. You know, we don't want to get out of here, particularly after OJ. Get out of here. Let's see. That's the line of the, what is this book about? A good white guy detective. All the villains are black. That's what this book is about. It's not even per se about who killed Tupac and Biggie, because I can't say that I've learned anything in this book where I could say, oh yeah, based on Labyrinth, this is who I think killed Tupac and Biggie. I have no information about that at all. All I can say is this book, this story, is about an alleged good white guy and lots and lots and lots of bad black people. End of story. And I still don't know who killed Tupac and Biggie. Watch out for that Suge Knight fella. Everybody is scared of him. Really dangerous. He might have killed 1,500 people this week. Whew, wow. Anything else I need to make sure I get in? I think Henry in Chicago had talked about it felt like regularly an effort to shore up a witness. We got to have a good white guy, so we really got to go over top. And we got to have some non-white people to say that we got a good white guy. They say that Sergio Robledo, Poole's former lieutenant in South Bureau Homicide, was a man who many of his fellow officers had believed would one day become Los Angeles' first Hispanic chief of police. Got to racialize as a non-white person. Until he resigned from the LAPD to take a second job as executive at the corporate CIA Kroll Associates. If Bernard Parks imagined he could discredit Russell Poole, Robledo warned the chief had better think again. Poole was among the most honest and industrious police officers he had ever worked with, said Robledo, and possibly the most. Now we got Rafael Perez is the worst, the most corrupt, the most lying, the most gangster officer we've ever had, and a chameleon, and a shapeshifter. While Russell Poole is the most thorough detective I've ever encountered. Everything Poole does, he writes down, scoffing at the suggestion that Poole might have exaggerated what took place in his meetings with Chief Parks and other high-ranking officers. You're never going to catch Russ lying. Brian S. Bentley says police are trained to lie. Non-white person says, hey, you're never going to catch Russell Poole, virtuous white man, lying. What is this book about? Virtuous white man. Lots and lots of bad black people. The jailhouse informant. Didn't we get that last book where jailhouse informant? That was the whole book, right? Julius Butler. Yep, I heard He said he did it. He told me everything in his penis. Oh my God. Did you? It's so much like the last book we ran, right? Geronimo. Oh my goodness. You got to look at his penis. He just enjoys beating up black people. He loves it. Just go out and beat up and stomp on some black people. Yes. I heard him. He confessed it all to me. Yes. With a hard penis. Shaft, Shaft, Earl Tidyman, and Mel comes through because I'm not reading it. Unless we have someone who wants to volunteer, I'll take that. I would love to have Mel read it. I have to see if she has time. But Shaft, that would break our L.A. Dark Alliance, I guess, would round it out unless we could get a really good book on Rodney King and the L.A. riots to really round it out so we could really tap everything from the decade. But maybe we'll have to come back to that. But Shaft, would love to do that one to wrap our summer up, get some fiction in, homoerotic. Have to read Shaft next. Anything else? Make sure. Yeah, I've got all my notes here. Everybody good? Anything else folks need to make sure they share before we wrap up? Zoom folks, everybody satisfied? Nothing they left out? Grand. We will conclude next Thursday. Last segment, Randall Sullivan. I didn't come into this believing Suge Knight had killed everybody. I had hoped we would get a little bit more information. I didn't know if it was going to be bereft of footnotes. But wow, reading this, I'm not surprised, especially since they have a movie based on this and there are lots of other theories that are similar to this. And I'd heard people reference this book like this is serious journalism. And if you really want to know something about the notorious B.I.G. killing and Tupac's killing, read this book, man. This Randall Sullivan guy and blah, blah, blah. Like, why, if anything, woo, this would just be another reminder in terms of how big a problem this is, racism, white supremacy, and the confusion. If you have black people read a book like this and it's not, wow, it sounds like this Randall Sullivan guy despises black people. And there are no footnotes. Like, either or would be reason to have lots of critiques, questions, suspicion. We'll wrap up next week. Hope it has been constructive. Worthy of your summertime Thursday evenings. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Wow, there have been so many reports on workplace racism. Even came up, I guess, a little bit here this week with Chief Parks. I think that's workplace racism right there because they talked about they demoted Chief Bernard Parks and accused him of sabotaging this white person and all the rest of it. And then he's getting this job to try to help out the black people on the job. Incidentally, I don't think white people would allow a workplace to function like that, but whatever. We'll be here tomorrow. Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need folks who can think at a high level to sift through the lies and deception, anti-blackness of this system. In addition to being sober, you're going to be out and about. Not a good time to be in verbal confrontations with strangers. We have so many folks who are armed and stressed and all the rest of it. You're out and about in public. Somebody is being rowdy and hostile. Exit. If you didn't leave your residence, prepare to kill and or die. This is not the time. You don't want to be surprised. And I'm like, oh, wow, this person has a Glock. Or, oh, wow, this person has an entire entourage armed. Ready to kill. I was just going to Krispy Kreme. Not the best situation. Additionally, if you're going out and about, if you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, doing the small things to be safe, and we need our attention to be alert. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all.
for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.